Hey, folks. Today's program sponsored by one of my favorite sponsors, Sunset Lake Sebade. SunsetLakeSebade.com. Use the code LEFTISBEST. You get 20% off. Folks, they have tinctures. They have new tinctures, actually, that are flavored as well. They have the natural tasting tincture, which is fantastic. Now, they also have mint and citrus as well. They also have a more concentrated tincture. I think that's the word, that delivers more CBD per dropper.
May I say, I have an anecdote quickly on that dropper, the one with a ton of CBD in it.
Yeah.
I used it Wednesday night before the Thursday show because I like, you know, I want to be as fresh because I'm hosting the
what
show.
What are you saying, solo. Like on other nights? Like you're just like, yeah, whatever.
Well,
I can wing it tomorrow.
I go to bed earlier because I got to wake up earlier and, you know, whatever. And I had a great one of the best sleeps I've had in weeks that because of that tincture.
It has made a material difference in my life in terms of both in terms of how much sleep I'm getting and how much other prescription sleep medications I am not taking. So that's awesome. But they also have smokables. They have keef. They have flower, I guess you'd say, or bud. And they have pre-rolls. They have infused fudge and gummies. They have coffee that has infused CBD with it. And the coffee is changes from time to time, but great blends. It's a great weekend brew for me when I want to be chill, but I still need my caffeine. And I've also found it be very helpful, frankly. When I have my kids, I have my kids a lot this month, it just so happens, and over the past couple of weeks. And one of the ways Daddy does not get too angry at the kids when they keep doing the same thing that I've asked them not to do multiple times, we have to get into it, I'll pop a gummy. And it'll help. It'll help. It'll smooth out the rough edges. They also have a salve that has been great for my eczema. People use it, it has arnica. People use it for muscle tension. They have a lotion, hand lotion.
I love that lotion.
And here's the thing. All of their products have a tremendous amount of integrity. They have third-party analysis of exactly every single thing that's in them. You can check it out on their website. And they have great business practices, $15 minimum wage, mostly employee-owned company. They have donated thousands upon thousands of dollars to things like nurses' strike funds and Give Directly and food banks. Just an all-around great company, great product. Check it out, SunsetLakeSebade.com. Use the code LEFTISBEST for 20% off. And now we will start this program. It is Friday, February 4th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. We've got a packed show for you today on the program running for Ohio's 11th Congressional District. Nina Turner will be joining us on the program, followed by not running for office, but host of the Benjamin Dixon Show. Ben Dixon will be here. And then, surely barred from office, comedian David Cross will be joining us, tell us about his new special and a new TV show he's got. Meanwhile, more details of civilian casualties in the ISIS raid announced by Joe Biden yesterday. And U.S. claims info of Russian false flag op as both Russia and U.S. increased troop levels in the region. Speaking of adding, the U.S. adds over 460,000 jobs in January. More Democratic representatives publicly support Congressional Staff Union Drive. The Bessemer, Alabama Amazon workers are beginning their second attempt at electing a union. Kansas governor vetoes Republican congressional map. Democrats in New York release theirs. Biden administration says Omicron in the rearview mirror, except when it comes to expelling immigrants under the Trump-instituted Title 42. More details on the historically black college and universities across the country getting bomb threats. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. It is Casual Friday. I can prove it because I am wearing a soft collar shirt. And Emma is wearing a, I would say it's a full, I can't tell if that's a mock turtleneck or a full turtleneck,
no, it's a full.
Emma Vigeland.
Is it's
it?
Full. It's full.
Because I feel like a full turtleneck, you got to roll down it so full.
Well,
yeah,
I mean, are you really going to cast aspersions on the legitimacy of my turtleneck?
Listen, I don't like the full turtlenecks, and I don't like the mock turtlenecks. I mean, I like them on you, but I'm saying I can't wear them because I find them too irritating to my neck.
You're being an antagonist today.
Yep,
yeah.
I'm in a mood.
You want a slice? You want a dice? Want to get...
What? Did you just, like, break into one of the songs from the new West Side Story?
A very, very, very niche Real Housewives of New York reference. It just came to my mind. Anyway, how are you doing?
Well, you know how I'm doing. When you're a jet, you're a jet all the way. To your first cigarette, to your last...
I'm a shark.
Right.
Okay. And also, we did not do the Casual Friday intro. So that's how we don't know.
That's what threw everything off.
Yeah.
That's why I felt like there was something weird going on.
I know. I realized it halfway through.
Folks, don't forget, you can go and see this program live either in Boston or Brooklyn, or frankly, they're going to be so different, the shows. You can see both, and you would feel good about it. I can tell you right now, we've got a couple of special guests in addition to the announced guests, Nally Scherr, John Benjamin, Larry Murphy in Boston. We've got a couple of special guests. Special guests that are lined up in Brooklyn. I don't know who we're going to have yet. That's the way we're rolling with this.
Wow. And that's the one that's coming up sooner.
It's coming up sooner.
All right.
But, yeah, it's just down the street. And so, you take it easy. Breeze in.
It's our home court.
It's our home court. So we're going to be doing a lot of, tricks, like spinning the balls on our fingers, that type of thing.
Like the Globetrotters.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I guess that's the kind of basketball we're playing.
That's right. All right. Let's get into this. Obviously, there's multiple stories from a foreign policy perspective that we've got going on right now. The buildup of both Russian forces on the border of Ukraine and U.S. forces, not nearly the same amount, but heading into neighboring countries of the former Soviet Union in many ways to... as like, I guess, a second line of defense. But meanwhile, we also have Joe Biden coming out and announcing yesterday at the White House, confirming reports that the U.S. military carried out a commando attack in northern Syria. And the collective sigh of relief that we heard in this country, that this guy... who nobody seemed to know who he was, in a ISIS force that is severely diminished, was palpable. I'm being facetious. Here's Joe Biden.
Last night, operating on my orders, the United States military forces successfully removed a major terrorist threat to the world, the global leader of ISIS, known as Haji Abdullah. He took over as leader of ISIS in 2019 after the United States counterterrorism operation killed al-Baghdadi. Since then, ISIS has directed terrorist operations targeting Americans, our allies and our partners, and countless civilians in the Middle East, Africa, and in South Asia. Our team is still compiling the report, but we do know that as our troops approach to capture the terrorist, in a final act of desperate cowardice, he, with no regard to the lives of his own family or others in the building, he chose to blow himself up, not just to the vest, but to blow up that third floor, rather than face justice for the crimes he has committed.
What's the evidence of that?
The
cowardness.
There's so much about this that I just don't understand what they think that they're doing. I mean, this is sort of, you know, maybe this is about trying to show some measure of strength to Putin I don't know the rationale behind that, but I honestly, the idea that you're going to do a White House briefing on someone who even U.S. intelligence barely was aware of.
Someone who will be replaced in a second and has no, I mean, yes, ISIS is severely diminished. That's the case.
He's the global, let's be clear, he's the global leader of ISIS in the same way that I am the global leader of the Majority Report.
Right.
And we will know more about this, but it's quite clear at this point that you're talking about 13 bodies who came out of that building.
Including six children.
Six children.
Yeah.
Most were killed. This is according to the New York Times. Most were killed, U.S. officials said, when al-Qashari refused to surrender and instead detonated explosives that killed him and members of his family. Most. Now, I've been reading reports of U.S. raids, bombing runs, drone attacks, military operations in the way that we did today for almost 18 years to the day, maybe a month and a half off. And they always start like this. Fact, they usually start a little bit more obscured, and they end up revealing that we end up killing more civilians than we even reported at the beginning, that it did not go down in the way that the military suggests.
Yep.
And I don't know how you get up there and justify this guy killing civilians when the ratio of person that we wanted to apprehend, which I also don't believe, to civilians that we killed was 1 to 12?
I mean, they're really just rehashing or recycling the human shields excuse. I mean, and so it, was the intelligence not aware that there were at least, even if they were taking their claims at face value, that he detonated a bomb that killed a bunch of other people on that third floor. Even if we're taking that at face value, which we should not, you had to be aware that there were other people in there. And yet the U.S. military made a calculation that getting this global ISIS leader, who, again, if some other militant will just crop up in the end, was more important.
And how many of the people who lived in that neighborhood, in that building, are going to now sign up with ISIS?
Yeah.
Like, how long do we need to engage in this to understand it is ineffective with supposedly what we claim its purpose is? And also, let's be clear, you can draw a direct line to the killing of these civilians and the hundreds of thousands of civilians who came before them in Iraq and in parts of Syria as a function of this, with decisions that were made 20 years ago to invade Iraq. And it is the gift that keeps on giving to the people in this region. And of course, those people who made those decisions have suffered not only have suffered no consequences, but are, you know, enjoying retirement, painting things, are feted at the White House, are brought on as, you know, heroes. Dick Cheney shows up at the, you know, in Congress the other day. David Frum and Bill Kristol, Ari Fleischer, they're all doing fine. Mm-hmm. They're all doing fine. And so, I don't understand why they came out and talk about this. I don't know who it is that they think is impressed by this anymore. But it is.
There's also some appetite to, like, post Afghanistan pullout. They want to look tough too.
I guess that's what it is. Meanwhile, our sanctions are destroying Afghan society and killing more and more people than
and displacing
the Taliban.
Them. And displacing them, because now there's going to be millions of refugees that are seeking refuge outside of Afghanistan.
Yeah, and it's unclear exactly where they go, frankly, at this point. The one good decision he made was to pull out of Afghanistan, followed by a series of bad decisions in terms of, you know, what we still owe that country, regardless of who is running it.
Reparations.
Or just not undercutting their ability to feed their own people.
That's the bare minimum. I'm just saying that there should be a real conversation about reparations to the Iraqi people and the Afghan people.
We're going to talk to Nina Turner, who we interviewed just about an hour ago, running for office in Ohio, just after these words from our sponsors today. Tough to make that transition. Really just unbelievable. We have an Instagram account, which I don't really know how to work. All of our social media, folks should know. I mean, I do my own Twitter. Or at least I hire the team of people that work on my Twitter, separate from the show. Like, it's just a whole squad of people that I enlist. No, that's not true. But Dorsey runs, he does our YouTube, he does our Twitter, he does the show and the Instagram. Every now and then, I want to go on and see what's on our Instagram. Mm-hmm. And a while back, I forgot about this, I switched my VPN. I have ExpressVPN on my phone. Super easy. I mean, like, I totally forget about it. And a while back, I switched it to California because I was trying to place myself in a different place to watch some football.
Okay.
And I'd forgotten about that. And I got a panic message from Dorsey. Like, is there somebody in California who's logging into our Instagram account? I'm like, oh, that's me. How do I do it? Well, I do it through ExpressVPN.
That was such a long road.
I know it was, but it just I saw the copy and it reminded me. Internet service providers operate like monopolies. Worst of all, many ISPs log your internet activity and sell that data to big tech companies or advertisers. Well, good luck, Meta or whatever you're calling yourselves these days, because ExpressVPN has me on a server in California. ExpressVPN is a simple app. It works for your computer or your smartphone. It encrypts all of your network data, and it tunnels it through a secure VPN server so that your ISP cannot see any of your activity. So much of your life is on the internet, and that's the reason I recommend ExpressVPN as the best way to hide your online activity from your ISP. You just download the app, tap one button on your device, and you're protected. You literally completely forget about it. You don't notice anything. Until the guy who runs your Instagram account says, someone's locked in from California.
Mm-hmm.
ExpressVPN does all of this without slowing your connection one iota. There's a myriad of reasons to want privacy when you're surfing the web, and ExpressVPN is the way to do it. So stop handing over your personal data to ISPs and other tech giants who mine your activity and sell off your information. Protect yourself with the VPN I trust to keep me private online. Visit expressvpn.com/majority. That's ExpressVPN.com/majority to get 3 extra months free. Go to expressvpn.com/majority right now to learn more. I will say this, you know, that Facebook or Meta, whatever they call themselves, their market capitalization like dropped by billions mm-hmm. yesterday. It's because people are finding different ways in which they can't track them online.
Oh.
And it's hurting their business. Like, God, I feel horrible about that. And it's also sort of disgusting. We realize like how much data they're collecting to sell off you. Also, I've mentioned this before. We have a merch shop for Majority Report. And we would not have one were it not for Shopify. If you run a business, well, you can supercharge your knowledge, your sales, and your success with Shopify. It's the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big business. So upstarts, startups, established businesses alike, podcasts that want to sell merch. You can sell everywhere, synchronize your online and in-person sales, which we're going to have the opportunity to do when we do our live show.
Ah, the big live. I mean, we can still call it that.
Yeah. And it makes it easy for you to effortlessly stay informed. Now, obviously for us, you know, our merch is not the focus of our business. But that's not true with most online businesses. Selling stuff is what they do.
Mm.
Now you can reach your customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps. Includes Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. Plus, gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting of conversion rates, profit margins, and beyond. It's more than a store. Shopify grows with you. This is what is known as possibility, folks, and it is powered by Shopify. You go to shopify.com/majority. All lowercase, shopify.com/majority for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Check it out. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/majority, all lowercase. Shopify, shopify.com/majority. Check it out. All right. Now we're going to run this interview we did with, and we should say all of the links will be in the podcast description and the YouTube thing. And if you want the show free of commercials, you can support the free show by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. You get the free show free of commercials and you get the fun half.
Mm.
So do yourself and us a favor. Quick break and then right into the interview with Nina Turner. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. With us now, it is a pleasure to welcome, I believe, back to the program, Senator Nina Turner, candidate for Congress in Ohio's 11th Congressional District. Nina Turner, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Sam. It's good to be here with you and Emma.
So this is your second run for Congress. The district is a little bit different. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But why are you taking a second bite at this apple?
Well, the same reasons that motivated me to run during the special election last year still exist. People are suffering. They need a fierce advocate. The greater Cleveland area, but particularly Cleveland itself, is the poorest city of its size in the country. Right now, people are really crying out for champions, and that is what this run is about. It was about that for me in 2021, and those reasons still remain the same in 2022.
Last election, and we're talking the primary. I mean, this is largely it's a blue district, maybe even more so now. So this is the primary. Really, is the end all be all, as it were, more or less. And so give us a sense of what happened last time, because it appeared that you were, I mean, certainly in terms of like early polling, to the extent that there was any, you were in the lead. And then as the election drew near, things changed. What give us a sense from your perspective of what exactly happened both in terms of the momentum of the race, but also what you've seen after the fact?
Well, a lot of dark money flooded into the district in a very concentrated way to pollute and dilute the will of the people. And for our campaign, yes, the grassroots were right there with us, Sam. They really came through. Ohio was my second highest donor state. We raised from every zip code in the 11th congressional district. So the grassroots dollars were certainly there to try to help us win this race. But when you have dark money flood in the way that it did, I was caricatured in a way that is very harmful to Black women. You know, that whole angry Black woman caricature, which, hell, it's a lot to be angry about, but it's the way that they did it. And that overtook us towards the end of the race. There was on my number one competitor's website, they put a red box up, really signaling to dark money groups what to say and what to do against me. So this was really a fight against dark money when it came to the very end of that race. And then also, Sam and Emma, thousands of Republicans actually voted in the special election, thousands of them. And that had an impact, too.
Have you guys gone back and looked at the data? I mean, I imagine what you do is you look at it from a district by district basis and you see, wow, there was a lot of votes from this mostly Republican district that came in this Democratic primary. Is that the way that you can say that with confidence?
That's exactly right. We looked at where people were voting at and how many voted at least one time in a Republican primary and then twice in a Republican primary. And we found thousands of them. Also, our campaign has emails from certain Democrats encouraging Republicans to vote in the primary. So between looking at the data points and some of the emails that we have with Democrats saying they want to try to stop me, do everything that they can to try to stop me, it was the confluence of those things. And then also young people were not, you know, did not vote at as high a level as we would want them to vote. Colleges were not in. It's really hard during an August election to have a younger people out there voting, especially those who are in school. And I want to assume that everybody goes to college. So it was a confluence of things. Certainly some things that my campaign can do differently and do better, which we are doing this time around, is to really saturate the field in a very strong way. I do want to make this finer point that we must have campaign finance reform in this country, whether it's the 11th congressional district in Ohio or whether it's the 11th congressional district in California. It is vitally important that we do not allow corporate forces to continue to pollute and dilute the voices of the people who live in various communities. It is really out of hand. It's happening all over the country. Look what happened to India Walton, by way of example. She actually won her primary and still the corporatists were able to walk her down and take over in the general election.
All right. So one more question of this, and we'll circle back and get to gerrymandering. But I want to give people a sense as to why this time around is going to be different. And we should say that there's not the same opportunity for Republicans to jump into that primary this time, right? Because
that's exactly right.
They have their own primary, whereas last time was a special election type of situation. And last time was a special election. And so the numbers of people who are going to participate are necessarily lower, and that increases the value of money that's coming in and inspiring people who wouldn't otherwise vote to vote. Is that basically that
is right, Sam. And because we have a U.S. Senate race this election cycle, all of the constitutional offices in Ohio are up. So governor, attorney general, et cetera, that is going to draw more people out to vote. And yes, each party is going to place their vote more likely with, you know, that of their party. So having Republicans cross over to the extent that they did during the special election, I don't think that is going to happen. Now, some may still do it, but I don't think it will be such a concentrated effort. Absolutely.
You talk about some of the dark money that flooded in, and it really was, I mean, so much dark money, millions of dollars, and a lot of it came from pro-Israel PACs, right? And that was some of the dark money that flooded in. This is in the news. Obviously, this Amnesty International report came out declaring Israel to be an apartheid state, and I saw that Representative Brown basically denied that is the case and seems to be backing up what a lot of her donor money that helped her out in this race is in favor of. So can you talk a little bit about her statement and what your response is to that?
I mean, it is important to make sure that we understand that any dark money from any group, this money that that people can donate and you don't have to, you can't draw a connection to who is giving that money. It is important that we know what is happening. As far as making sure that the 11th congressional district is taken care of, the needs of the 11th congressional district, the people in this country, the people in the great state of Ohio should take precedence over anything. And that's important as well. So any dark money group, whoever it is, that should not be allowed to be able to take hold and take over pretty much and just follow the money. I mean, you're laying it out. Not only that, I mean, there were other dark money groups that were involved in this race, but just look at the finance reports. Even the owner of the New England Patriots donated. He is an avowed Trumpite. Others donated. And there is a recent article that came out from the Cleveland Plain Dealer that lays out some of these people, from the Browns owners to others, donated to a PAC that put out racist literature against the new mayor in the city of Cleveland, Mayor Justin Bibb. And some of those same donors also donated to my number one opponent. So follow the money.
Yeah, so that gives you a sense of like what their actual agenda is, and
Jimmy Haslam is no Boy Scout.
And let me say this: anti-blackness is a thing too, mm-hmm. And so we got to understand that, and let's talk about that in a deep way. That is important that we don't lose sight of a district that is a majority African American district, a district that was created because of people like Congressman Stokes. You know, that was a hard-fought district. As a matter of fact, Congressman Lewis Stokes was the first African-American congressman in the great state of Ohio. And to fast forward to 2021 and have other forces determine who would be elected because of the way that money flooded in, really, it should cause concern for any community.
And this isn't just a question of the candidate when we talk about anti-blackness. We're talking about issue sets that are important to the black community, and ones that are particularly pertinent to the black community, and that's what we're really talking about too when we talk about that. And with that said, it's a good lead in. Your opponent last time, who's now a sitting congresswoman, just came out and 8 months ago was saying, "I'm not for Medicare for all. I'm for a public option," which, you know, I don't know that you call it a half step. Maybe it's a quarter step. But it ultimately does not really take us where we need to go. It does not recognize healthcare as a right for everybody. She has now come out and co-sponsored the Medicare for All bill that Pramila Jayapal has introduced into the House this year. What's your sense of how relevant is that? I mean, you know, there's people want to have a vote on Medicare for All. I think there's very good arguments as to whether or not you have that when you know you're going to lose, because it's supposedly going to, you know, assess who's for it or not. But people can take a vote if they know it's not going anywhere. They can take that vote too,
or they can co-sponsor it, even if they don't necessarily believe in it. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So give us your sense of like, what's the difference? I mean, how, as a voter, I care about Medicare for All. Why would I vote for you over Chantel Brown if I care about Medicare for All?
Because there's a difference between co-signing on something and getting out there fighting for it, putting something on the line for it. And that is what I have been doing. And you don't have to be an elected official to say that you stand up for Medicare for All. So while I am delighted that people are seeing the light and that this person is following my lead and the lead of other progressives that have been on the front lines fighting for it, the difference is, are you going to fight for it, or are you just going to sign on to something because it is popular and you want to use it to leverage? Those are the differences. I have been fighting for Medicare for All, not just signing on to a bill. And also, you know, Congresswoman Jayapal introduced that bill last year. This person could have signed on to that bill right away, but it's curious that she only signed on to the bill in February. I launched my candidacy in the latter part of January. So we'll see. But let me put it on the other side. We do want people to stand up and say Medicare for all is the right thing to do. But beyond that, are you going to fight for it? Are you going to put something on the line for it? So I'm really happy that she is following my lead.
And we should just say it's also a question, it seems to me, of, you know, just the voters assessing the depth of sincerity. I mean, you know,
that's
like, I think it's a good thing to have more sponsors for Medicare, but it's also, you know, we had this dynamic in New York State when Cynthia Nixon ran, all of a sudden Andrew Cuomo tacked to the left dramatically. And so, you know, I attribute a lot of some progressive policies under Cuomo to Governor Nixon. But I mean, it would have been better to have the real thing in there. And so how do you communicate that to the public when she has the ability to say, I co-sponsored this? How do you simply lay out, like, there's nothing behind that co-sponsoring?
Right. I mean, because in the debate, Jess, I'm old enough to remember what happened at the City Club debate, as you both laid out what the position was then. And now all of a sudden, seeing the light. So seeing the light is a good thing. Is that seeing of the light sincere? Are they going to put something on the line for it? My record of fighting for Medicare for all definitely speaks for itself. So I'm just going to have those kinds of conversations, Sam. And again, though, if the progressive movement, what the policies that we are fighting for are not only popular, they are necessary. So to the extent that this movement is forcing people, especially those who are elected to office, to come further to the left is one step. That's a good thing. But I continue to say, are they going to put something on the line for it? There is a difference. And Greater Cleveland fighters, it's in our genes. It's everything about Greater Cleveland. The suffering there deserves somebody that's not just going to vote the right way or say the right things when it's popular to say those things, but somebody who is willing to make a sacrifice on behalf of the poor, the working poor, and the barely middle class. So I'm going to state my case, and I will always, you know, also continue to say, welcome. The water is fine. I'm glad that you are seeing the light on this. Finally, you didn't feel that way last year.
Yeah, right. Exactly. What are some of the other policy differences that you feel are like starkest between you and your opponent? Because obviously there's a sincerity gap with Medicare for all, but there are other areas in which you are more progressive than her and policy sets that you would push for if you were to defeat her in this primary. So what are some of those that you would prioritize for your potential new district?
Well, definitely the legalization of marijuana is vitally important to the Black community, other communities of color, but particularly the Black community that has suffered the brunt of the war on crime that targeted the Black community and really has had a generational impact. We must not only legalize marijuana, we must expunge records, and the federal government must ensure that ownership of said companies within the ecosystem of cannabis, that Black people have the requisite impact in order to be able to chip away at generational wealth, or generate the inequality within generational wealth. Making sure that we cancel student debt. You know, I've been out there along with some other folks, including some elected officials, that have been very clear to the president that you can use your pen right now and cancel student debt. It would both have an impact from a racial standpoint. The Black community carries the largest amount of student debt, Black women especially. And it also has a class component that everybody, those 45 million or so people who are suffering under the weight of student debt, would get relief. So not being afraid to both embrace and what the Democratic Party is doing when we are really in service to the people, but also being willing to push the party and make requisite demands. We know one party has lost its ever loving mind, and that's the Republican Party, to quote my grandmother. And then the other party, my party, needs to use the power that the people gave us in 2020 to absolutely change their material conditions. So Emma, it is the difference between just kind of going along to get along and somebody who is going to fight. And we know that the progressives in Congress have been the ones holding up the president's agenda even more so than the corporatist Democrats. Democrats. And we know two corporatists that we can use for an example here, Senators Manchin and Sinema, but they are not the only ones. What does that pushing get? When we think about putting a moratorium on student debt cancellation, we know that it was going to expire in February, but because of progressives who are elected, but also the progressive movement saying you cannot let that lift that moratorium, we got it extended until May. So that's just one example of what can happen when you are willing to fight and not accept no for an answer when you have the courage to ask for more. So fundamentally, I am running again in this race because I have the courage to ask for more. I have a lived experience that connects to the pain of the people in my district, and I am going to continue to stand up and fight for them. I've been side by side with the House of Labor, both as an elected when I was in the state Senate. I continue to be side by side with them even when I was not actively elected. So my record on these issues speak for themselves. It is not just when I have the fancy title. It is being side by side with the people who have the greatest needs. And I'm going to continue to do that no matter what the outcome of this race is.
Let's talk. I mean, you've had that experience in the Ohio Senate and on the Cleveland City Council. From time to time, I would have conversations with progressives in the House now as it is. When you say fight, like, what does that mean? Like, what are the mechanisms? What are the tactics that, and what do progressives in Congress need to get more wins and more dramatic wins than a moratorium on student debt? Like, what are the specific sort of mechanisms in which when we say we're fighting, what are we doing?
Well, first of all, it is utilizing the grassroots. Progressive elected officials cannot do what they do without progressive activists out in the streets, in the highways and the byways on a regular basis. Those two things go together. So while we are pushing to get more progressives elected, I would say to all levels of government, we have to continue to marry that effort with the grassroots, the outcry of the people. Now, when you are elected, there must be a consequence. The Progressive Caucus is the largest caucus in the Congress right now, and there must be a consequence. We should be able to hold out for something that is better. For example, the members of the squad did do that when it came to the bipartisan infrastructure bill and also the Build Back Better. They said, if we separate these things, we will never get the Build Back Better. Now, the Progressive Caucus itself started on the right path, but somehow, for whatever reason, decided that they were going to allow the separation of those two bills. You had six members of that caucus, known as the squad, say that we are going to stand by our word, not because we don't want the bipartisan infrastructure bill to pass. Of course they do. But because they understood that if you separate the two, you decrease the likelihood, you give up your leverage. So Sam and Emma, that is an example of being able to use leverage. And imagine if more progressives in that progressive caucus use the power that they have to leverage and put up a fight. Why should Senators Manchin and Sinema get to have all the fun? They shouldn't get to have all the fun. And the progressives are on the side of justice. Again, the policies that we are fighting for are not just popular, they are necessary. So we got to have both the inside and the outside game. That was a long way of me saying inside, outside game, and not being afraid to use leverage in the same way that the squad did on the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better. And one other point to that. They didn't say no to that because they didn't care. They said that because they wanted the American people to have more.
Well, they were right. I mean, in the end, their assessment was right. Would there have been seven votes if you were in Congress at that time?
Oh, no doubt about it. Yeah, absolutely. Leveraging for more for the people of my district and the people of this country.
Well, there you have it. And in terms of your district, too, can you talk a little bit about how it was redrawn and what your opinions are on, you know, the gerrymandering of it as well?
Yeah, and I sigh a little bit when the last census time, 2010, I was in the legislature. And when the bill to draw the lines came for a vote, at that time, I voted against it because of gerrymandering. And here we are 10 years later, 11 years later, and we are facing the same impacts. So thank you for opening up this for me. This, we not only should we care about who goes to Congress, we have got to, we being Democrats, have got to fight harder to make sure that Democrats can win these legislative seats. That is where we're losing the most ground. Now, Emma, to answer your question directly, the Ohio Supreme Court declared that the lines were unconstitutional. We know that that lawsuits are, have been filed all over the country because Republicans control and they've been gerrymandering the hell out of these districts in a way that is a disservice to the voters in said states, including my state. What I do know right now is that Cleveland will be all in one district. I actually live in the city of Cleveland. And so what we don't know now is what the suburban communities that will be part of that greater Cleveland district will look like. But Cleveland will be kept whole this time and not be divided into two districts. Hopefully the Supreme Court will make a decision here soon. Petitions are due in March. That deadline was moved from February. So we will see what happens. Hopefully it is a fairer district. And when I say fair, I mean answering to the will of the voters of that of the district and not to what the GOP is trying to do and has done. So new district, new people, new direction. No matter what, a percentage of the people in the new district will not have had the opportunity to vote during the special election, and they should have the opportunity to have a choice.
Okay, now, so that raises two, there's two separate questions I have here, and there's two things that are going on simultaneously. One is that my understanding about the redistricting is that Democrats represent nearly, not quite 50% in terms
about
of like
45%.
45%. Mm-hmm. However, the projection in terms of the way that the lines have been drawn, to the extent that we know them, is that Republicans are going to have, I think it's a 15, is it a 15 seat contingent of Congress people from Ohio, that something like 13 of those seats are going to be Republican Congress people. That's pretty astonishing to have a 55% majority, theoretically, maybe maximum, in the state, and win a 85% of the congressional seats. I mean, I'm just doing the math off the top of my head, so forgive me, but that seems pretty nuts on one hand. On the other hand, the way this redistrict may go may actually help you specifically within your race. Is that right?
Well, they're definitely the Republicans, Sam. I want to stay on this part because this is not about me per se. This is not about me. Let me take per se about. It's not about me. When you have the kind of redistricting that is happening at the hands of the GOP right now, democracy cannot stand for that. And in the age of technology, we know that they are able to be more laser focused in their misdeeds. Definitely ignoring the will of the people. If you have laid out those numbers beautifully, even if it's off the top of your head, that they are going to ignore the will and also the political makeup of the great state of Ohio for their own political means. We, the collective we, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, Libertarian, no party, a little bit of country, a little bit of rock and roll, a little bit of gospel, a little bit of R&B, we cannot stand for this. This is absolutely wrong. And I'm glad that the Supreme Court said that the lines are unconstitutional. So I want to take me out of the equation just to say for democracy, this is absolutely wrong. And they should be smacked down on every term. Gerrymandering is a disservice to the people who live in respective states. Now, yeah, so I'm going to leave that right there.
Well, all right, let me ask you to just follow up with this, because New York is also redistricting. Now, it is the numbers are nowhere as absurd as they are in a place like Ohio or, let's say, Wisconsin, similar dynamic. In Wisconsin, it's even worse, right? I mean, Democrats win 52-54% of the vote, and they have 35% of the state Senate seats there. It's absurd. It's not democracy.
That's right.
But do you think, I mean, how should Democrats in a state like New York react when they see what's happening in Wisconsin, when they see what's happening in Ohio, they see what's happening in Pennsylvania? Can you be against this type of gerrymandering, but also say, but the Democrats also can't unilaterally just give up? I mean, because those two seats they may pick up in New York are going to offset at least some of the injustice that exists in maybe a state like Ohio, Wisconsin, or Pennsylvania.
Sam, when it comes to redistricting, I mean, we can't right the wrong by being wrong. If we hold the will of the people in our mind's eye, what is the legitimate political makeup of each state? And just draw the lines that way and compete. I know this might be a foreign concept, but compete for the votes and don't cheat and rig it in such a way that your party has the advantage. Look, both parties have gerrymandered. I get that, but it has become worse under, you know, with such technology that you can really laser focus, use that technology for these types of misdeeds. So whether it's a Democrat or Republicans drawing the line, whether it's Democrats or Republicans drawing the lines, I err on the side of drawing the lines in the way that best reflect the political makeup of the state. Even if you got to give up just a little bit, you're doing it for the people that you took an oath of office to serve. And it is not right for politicians to choose their constituents. It should be the other way around. And there are some issues that rise to the level of we should not comport ourselves in this way. And I think gerrymandering is one of those. The democracy is at stake. So neither party should do it.
All right. Well, let me just, in closing, tell us when the primary is and what folks can do to help you out to get that seventh vote. And hopefully, maybe we'll see in Texas, we'll get an eighth vote. And maybe in California, we'll get a couple more votes and close that gap the next time we're in a situation where there can be, where the leverage can be strong enough to, you know, not allow them to split apart two bills or whatever it is. What can folks do?
And hopefully in Nevada too, Sam. Amy Villela is taking another stab at it, so I'm going to throw her out there as well. We need as many progressives going to that Congress as we can. So folks can reach me at ninaturner.com. That is ninaturner.com. Time, treasure, and talent is necessary. The grassroots bubbling up yet again to help us compete in this race. The justice journey, justice is just that. It's a journey. It's not a destination. And the same reasons why, again, I ran the last time are still in play right now. We need champions in the Congress. People need champions. They need fighters. And I want the opportunity to be able to go to the Congress and serve my constituents in that way, to be able to push, not go along. To get along. And you know what? We had one of the greatest examples last year with the labor movement really bubbling up. And Sam, you and Emma know, you saw what the House of Labor was able to do. They were making demands within their workplace. And I overlay the types of demands they were making, better wages, better work conditions, better benefits. If we bring that to the macro level, that is the same thing that we should be fighting for the American people in general. Better wages, better benefits, and better conditions, which include Medicare for all, having paid family and medical leave, increasing the minimum wage, canceling student debt, legalizing cannabis, passing the PRO Act, protecting voting rights. This really is about creating, to quote Congresswoman Barbara Jordan, an America as good as its promise. And that is why Sister Turner is running, to continue to be in that tradition of freedom fighters that went against the grain, that went against the status quo, even at the expense of ridicule, to create an America as good as its promise for all people, no matter how they identify. That's why I'm running.
Nina Turner, running in Ohio's 11th Congressional District. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Nina.
Oh, thank you both for having me.
So we are back. Let's just keep going. We're packed today.
Packed.
Fully packed. It is now my pleasure to welcome back to the program, after a extended but not purposeful hiatus. We're moving around a lot.
That's what you say.
Well, I don't know. I guess we'll ask this guy. I mean, you can see right there. It's in a different location. I don't know if that's part of it. The proprietor of the Benjamin Dixon Show And hosting
afternoon.
How's it going, right?
How's it going, Sam and Emma? It's always good to be with you two.
Ben Dixon, welcome back to the program.
Good to see you.
How many shows are you doing now?
Well, you know, I've consolidated all the shows into one morning show, the Benjamin Dixon Morning Show, but it still has George on the clock with my sister, Georgia Fort, like it or not, with Rebecca Azor. So we got a lot. I mean, it's a lot going on, but we're making it work.
All right, good. I'm glad to hear it. Thanks for joining us. Busy day, a lot of stuff going on. I don't know what we should start. Let's start with just the Supreme Court pick, because in many respects, we're at that stage now in the Biden administration where it's pretty clear that legislatively they have failed to
do anything pretty substantial.
Well, I mean, they got the highway bill passed, right. The bipartisan infrastructure bill. But
the entire domestic agenda is dead.
It really appears in many respects, and it remains to be seen, and it certainly appears that Biden is not going to do the things that he can do unilaterally. It doesn't appear that he's going to do those things.
Right.
But the courts at this point, still hugely important. Maybe more so for, you know, our kids at this point than they will be in the near term. Biden came out and said that he was going to pick a black woman. There's and we will get to the sort of the fight that's brewing between Clyburn and really, as far as I'm concerned, the rest of the party. But I want to get your thoughts on this exchange. This was just a week ago. We finally found some audio of it and video, I guess. This is Senator Roger Wicker. He is the Republican senator from Mississippi on the Super Talk Mississippi radio show with host Paul Gallo. And listen to this.
The irony is that the Supreme Court is at the very same time hearing cases about this sort of affirmative racial discrimination.
Yes.
And while adding someone who is the beneficiary of this sort of quote, the majority of the court may be saying writ large, it's unconstitutional.
Fascinating.
There's Wicker. Has there, this is almost a rhetorical question, have there been any black senators from Mississippi? Do we know?
You know, that's a good question. I think there might have been some fluke of nature during the Reconstruction. We may have got someone from Hiram Revels comes to mind. I'm not a historian, but this is par for the course from Mississippi. I grew up in Mississippi, and you know, the fact that he tried to pass this off as if any black pick, because we don't have any names yet, right? We don't have any black women names yet. We have a relatively short list, but no one who's up for actual consideration yet. And he's made a blanket statement that that they're all beneficiaries of some type of affirmative action. And he clearly doesn't know the data that white women are literally the greatest beneficiaries of affirmative action, period. But, you know, I might be over his head down there in Mississippi.
We should also say this is a guy who was appointed to his senator ship.
He couldn't even win.
So that's where he gets his sense of entitlement from, it seems.
You need to earn these things.
Yeah.
Right.
By getting appointed and I think it was to replace Trent Lott. If I'm not mistaken,
he got appointed much like a judge.
He got appointed, and then of course he ran as an incumbent, had a big advantage there. But there are some names that have been banding around. We don't know yet, but there was just a story today, actually. Well, Clyburn has been pushing a candidate, Childs, who spent a significant amount of time as a labor lawyer fighting unions. I don't know if that's...
And representing companies who were the subject of discrimination complaints. Not the people making the discrimination complaints, the companies. Like, so the left and the people who are actually talking about, you know, there's these three candidates that are mostly being discussed. Unlike what the right tries to portray, we are actually talking about the substance of their qualifications.
Right.
But they want to pretend that that's not the case because it's an easy straw man and it's an easy way to drum up racial resentment. If you you got a job as or you lost your job as a white person and you feel like, oh, it's because my company has to make these racial quotas, et cetera, that's easy chum for them since there's no obscure way they can say this is too close to an election. I mean, this is what they've settled on.
Yeah, no, I, you know, just in sum total, it is, I actually want to start back with Jim Clyburn. You know, we don't just want any black woman. Black people don't want just any black woman. Candace Owens is a black woman. We'll pass. We want somebody who's going to fight for liberation. And so therefore, we're going to go down their qualifications. And I don't care if it's Jim Clyburn's great niece. I don't care. We'll fight him, especially if they're anti-union, anti-labor. If they have a history. Oh, I'd love that fight. We're ready for it.
What's fascinating is that Clyburn has chosen to basically make an issue. The two other, we should say, the two other candidates, Ketanji Brown Jackson and Leandra Krueger, both, and I cannot remember, one, they're both Ivy League grads in terms of law school. One is Harvard, one is Yale. I can't remember which is which. And so Clyburn is making his case that Michelle Childs represents a break from this. I mean, it's which is true, helpful, but not quite really the point. I mean, how does Clyburn get away with this type of posturing?
Well, easily, he's had the benefit of being the misleadership, the face of misleadership from the black community. See, there's always going to be, I don't really want to lay waste to Jim Clyburn this afternoon. I didn't really come to do that. But I mean, there are always people like him who are eager to facilitate a particular type of blackness. But Jim Clyburn has been very efficacious at stopping a liberation style of blackness. So he has a form of blackness, but he denies the progressive power thereof.
Well, I mean, and it just the same people who are pushing, or well, Clyburn's pushing for this woman Childs, but so is Lindsey Graham. Mm. And so is Tim Scott, I believe. Mm. I mean, that says pretty much everything.
Well, she's, and we should be clear, she's I think a circuit court judge in South Carolina. So, I mean, that's the home court advantage there. But it's also going to be interesting to see how this implicates the possible leadership fight. I mean, there's a piece, I think, in the LA Times this week that, and I don't know, it's hard for me to imagine that Pelosi's going to stick around.
Yeah. Yeah.
To not be the leader of what will probably be the minority in the House, but could theoretically, she could be speaker again, theoretically, but hard to imagine that she just wants to be a member of the caucus. And this piece is talking about a three-way race between Steny Hoyer, Clyburn, and Hakeem Jeffries, which seems to me to be set up to really deliver it to Hakeem Jeffries.
Yes.
Because the other two, I don't know how old Steny Hoyer is, but Clyburn's also in his 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, how? What the?
Yeah, no, and Steny Hoyer is obviously not going to be Speaker of the House. I mean, he's had a, you know, relatively distinguished career, but he's been kind of a, if you've ever gone to a live event with Steny Hoyer, he's really, he's a liability when he speaks. He doesn't dot a dry cross.
Nancy Pelosi's not exactly like, you know, your best foot forward too, if you want to have someone communicate anything.
But I think that's why, like, I think they're drawing that contrast. Like, you couldn't possibly put, they're trying to make it a generational fight. You can't put Clyburn and Steny Hoyer next to King Jeffries and not kind of institute a generational style fight. But again, I've been following King Jeffries long enough to understand that everyone who's close to our age doesn't have our age's best interest at heart.
Right. Yeah. Right. But I just wonder if Clyburn loses this fight, you know, what kind of implications it would have on a leadership fight in that scenario. But
well, one thing to that, though, I think that they're playing politics as usual and they don't really see. Do you think they see the shellacking that's coming their way? Like, they might need to consider clearing out all of the leadership, because once the Republicans are done, no, once the Democrats are done destroying themselves, I think we're going to have a real clean slate. I don't think they're going to survive what's coming up in the midterms.
I mean, they're just like this commitment to these same old people in leadership. And like, you know, you've talked about this, Sam, this belief in themselves as the only people who have knowledge. I mean, the narcissism of it. We are the only ones fit to lead and steward the party through this time. And really what it is just they're clinging to power as the base of the party has been banging on the doors and trying to break them down for new ways of doing things. And yet the leadership is lagging to such a degree that it's like a very jarring and an uncomfortable tension there. I don't know how long they can. I mean, Pelosi seems to just want to do it indefinitely. She's running again. Blows my mind, but
it's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. And then, of course, this is also the same problem we have with Breyer. And now we're looking at a situation where there is no working majority in the Democratic caucus in the Senate. We're hoping that that Lujan, senator from New Mexico, just had a stroke, recovers quick enough before someone else has a stroke in the Democratic Senate caucus. But it really is nuts. And speaking of that same sort of like problem, here is Joe Biden praising Mitch McConnell. And again, like, you know, we had example after example of Biden and Pelosi publicly saying we need a strong Republican Party, separating Donald Trump from these Republicans as if there was a significant difference between them.
Right.
This is the guy who broke the Senate. One is a Senate institutionalist. The other is the one who broke the Senate by not allowing a hearing on Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee. Here's Joe Biden. What was this? Just from yesterday?
Yeah, at the National Prayer Breakfast. So this is like where Democrats embarrass themselves and show fealty to conservatives for no reason.
And Vice President Harris, Majority Leader Schumer, Mitch McConnell. Mitch, I don't want to hurt your reputation, but we really are friends. and that is not an epiphany we're having here at the moment. You've always done exactly what you've said. You're a man of your word, and you're a man of honor. Thank you for being my friend.
I mean, just aside from the fact that that's not true.
Yeah.
The guy has broken many, many deals with Democrats over the years in terms of procedure, in terms of what they would do, in terms of giving hearings. I mean, that's just
the Merrick Garland, this is too close to an election thing. Okay, then we're going to push Amy Coney Barrett through, just off the top of my head.
I mean, this is just absurd. But from as a political standpoint, what is wrong with these people?
You know, I think they're telling us who they really are. It's difficult, but if I try to examine Joe Biden specifically through the lens of rationality, then I have to come to the conclusion that he's complicit, that Mitch McConnell is really his friend, and that this is all going swimmingly for them because, well, he doesn't look like he's as upset as the rest of his constituents now, does he?
But I mean, even if Mitch McConnell is his friend, he's still doing politics, and it's either he thinks this is going to hurt Mitch McConnell because, but I don't understand how that's supposed to work. Or he just doesn't think it's relevant to characterize Republicans in a certain way in terms of like going into a midterm election.
But if this is all a game to them, all a theater, you know, kabuki theater, then they're all just doing their parts and everything is going according to plan for them. I mean, I don't know if I can actually believe that, but the only thing that makes that clip rational to me is if he actually means what he says and that he does not see Mitch McConnell as a political rival, because otherwise they need to have the 25th Amendment invoked.
But even if it's kabuki theater, he's not performing the theater.
Well, then you know what I'm saying? You got me on that one.
That's my complaint. Like, I mean, frankly, yeah. I don't care if they're friends or not.
Yeah, you can be in private. You want to have a beer with Mitch McConnell, I guess. But if you're,
I would find it grotesque personally, and yes. I'll be honest, I would not be capable of doing that. But if they can do that and still be a political rival,
deliver. Yeah.
But being a political rival means not in this day and age. It means characterizing your opponents in a certain way. That
he's definitely not trying to do the art of war. He's not trying to do any jujitsu here, right?
No.
I don't think he's trying to be more outcunning than Mitch McConnell. So I'm at a loss.
He thinks that there is. I mean, and it's. It's insane, but it's part of the fact that he's been a creature of Washington for decades. He thinks that there is political value in appearing like you're working with Republicans. When how many mountains of evidence or that you're being congenial or that you're being nice to them? We have mountains and mountains and mountains of evidence that is not the case.
This man is still living in the 80s, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, and even then, I don't even know what value that created. It's just, it's a dead strategy. Although, I mean, Biden won the presidency by saying he was bringing the country together. So I guess I'm contradicting myself a bit. But to me, that was more of a Trump backlash situation. And now let's get back to, you know, defeating Republicans as they are. And that was too close for comfort in and of itself, because as Sam was saying, they consistently refused to tie Donald Trump to the rest of the Republican Party.
Yeah, no, and I mean, to that end, Sam, I have no idea what Joe Biden is doing here, to be honest with you.
It's not, it's insane as far as I can tell. But all right, I want to touch on one other story. It was about 2 years ago, I guess. Was it 2 years ago that Jacob Frey, the mayor of Minneapolis, said no more no-knock warrant arrests or home invasions, I guess. I mean, this is where the cops, SWAT team shows up. They bust into a house unannounced.
Yeah.
And
it's what killed Breonna Taylor in
Kentucky. Taylor in Kentucky and in the wake of the Floyd murder.
That's right.
The Minneapolis police supposedly ended this practice, and I don't know if we should play the video. It's a little bit disturbing. Maybe we cut out of it a little bit early, but let's play just the first part of that video. You see the police, and we will cut out of it before. But I know that you've been talking about this a lot, Ben. Why don't you just tell the general scene?
Yeah. So this is footage. This is body cam footage that was released yesterday by, I'm not sure if it was the Minneapolis police or the St. Paul police, because it was a joint action between those two police departments, as covered by my sister, Georgia Fort, who's there in the Minneapolis area. She obtained the body cam footage, and I've been sharing it all over Twitter, but it shows a police officer storming into Amir Locke's, into an apartment where Amir Locke was sleeping. And he, in the video, he's wrapped in a blanket, and the police officers in fewer than 9 seconds kill him on the scene.
It's 6 a.m. or 6:15 a.m. in the morning. The TV's on. He obviously fell asleep watching TV, wrapped in a blanket. Now, he has a weapon, according to the police. It's unclear, why, but he's not even named on the warrant.
That's right.
I mean,
a name on the warrant, and he was licensed to carry, according to reports from his family.
And this is, do we have the video?
Yeah.
All right, let's just play the first part of it and cut out before.
Yeah.
See the no-knockness of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sort of like how they're just sneaking in here. This is, it's 6 in the morning. They're picking the lock. They have the key, I guess.
Police search for it!
Police search for it!
Okay, and then 2 seconds later,
they kill him.
You never even see the guy's face, really.
I know. Well, you see him under a blanket.
Yep. Under the blanket, yeah. Sleeping.
Right.
Under.
Sleeping.
The The amazing thing about this is that on one hand, we have a society that seems to be like sort of barreling to the requirement that you carry guns. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we're starting to see that. On the other hand, here is basically you have a gun when people bust into your house. Like, presumably, this is why you have a gun, right? I mean, which one of these groups here in this is the good guy with the gun?
Yeah. Well, it's never the black person, for sure. Breonna Taylor is dead because of that. So is Philando Castile, who was licensed to carry. And that, if I'm not mistaken, that officer got away with killing him. That's the dream scenario that conservatives think of. NRA likes to promote is when someone breaks into your house late at night, early in the morning. And so Amir Locke was doing exactly what America tells you you should do. You should own a gun legally, properly, and you should be at home, not out doing anything wrong. Sleep, watching cartoons. What, I don't know what he was watching. He was wrapped up in his blanket. And yet none of that was enough to keep him from being killed in a country that celebrates the Second Amendment.
After George Floyd died, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey said that they were going to look at the no-knock warrants and get rid of them and, you know, have cops have to announce themselves. Nonetheless, apparently in this case, St. Paul police originally were not going to go for a no-knock warrant, and Minneapolis police insisted on it. And just another from last year, April 30, 2021, Care 11 investigates. Mayor Frey apologizes for no-knock raid, asked for an investigation. This was a different one. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey says he apologized Friday to the Coon Rapids woman who says whose home was mistakenly raided by a SWAT team at the request of Minneapolis police. This type of obvious breakdown in process and horrible mistake is unacceptable, period, Frey said.
Sure.
I mean, period. And it's going to happen again because Jacob Frey, and we mentioned this on Left Reckoning with GP Jacob, he's the perfect neoliberal mayor to come out and say like perfect, like he cares, but he doesn't care. He doesn't care. He has absolutely zero capacity to get the Minneapolis police under control.
And that's why these like little measures of directives and things like that are so ineffective. I mean, chokeholds were banned, I believe, in New York when Eric Garner was murdered. Was killed with one. So, like, I mean, no-knock warrants, we're not doing them anymore, except when we have to. If we really decide to, we're going to do it anyway. It's just, like, there is no way around wholesale and federal overhauls of the police with real consequences and an end to qualified immunity, actual prosecution of these people, and the demilitarization of the police in a way that is substantial and not just like a press release. I mean, Matt, the other day you called Biden the press release president. Like, how have the Democrats, and I know now we're bringing it back to the federal level, but like the idea that the Democrats have gotten away with doing zero on police reform after George Floyd and that there has not been substantive legislation. You have to get rid of the filibuster, but the fact that they want to fundraise off of it and they send out emails about racism and all this stuff and they've done nothing actually about it, that pisses me off. It really does. I mean, it was the same thing with gun violence. They talk a huge game on it and they want to use it so that they can get some donations. But when they actually have to change Senate procedure in order to get something done, they're unwilling to do it. It's awful.
What's the next step here? I mean, we saw, I guess, close to 2 years ago now, some of the most dramatic, consistent, well-attended protests and, you know, movement that was on the streets that we've seen in this country. I mean, you know, certainly since the Iraq War, maybe even before that, it supersedes it. And out of that, there was a couple of cities that I can think of that had some measure of reform. Much of that sort of walked back probably since then a little bit. But what's the answer after that doesn't work? Is it your sense that there are people who are willing to do that again for an extended period of time? Has COVID just sort of like soaked? I mean, what's the next step? If that didn't do it, what will?
Power. power, like real power. We got to snatch power back away from people like Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, the list of them, Jim Clyburn, the whole lot of them, because Democrats have had the uncanny gift of being able to satiate the masses with symbolism. Right. Now, the masses went out 2 years ago and did our part. Matter of fact, we did our part to try to help save people from COVID-19. This is the same leadership that is getting us killed from COVID-19. And I'm sorry, I don't distinguish at this point. We had about 400,000 underneath Trump. We had about 400,000 plus underneath Joe Biden. So to me, it is progressives and people who are of good faith, because we got some crappy progressives, too. But people of good faith need to get power and actually do something with that power. That's economic power, that's political power, and that's social power. We need all three.
Well, how does that happen at that point? I mean, the political power, I guess the economic power is fairly straightforward, although I don't know how. I mean, there's small donor fundraising, I guess, and there's some organizing as consumers to the extent that, you know, people can do that. I don't think that's, you know, particularly long-term effective or, you know, really the way you want to organize. So how do we get that political and societal power?
Well, the first step is for us to go ahead and make up our minds that the Democratic Party isn't going to do anything for us, and then govern ourselves accordingly. And it's for, I mean, the economic part, everyone has their own route to their own economic power. I think we, as people who are progressives, leftists, consider ourselves socialists, I think we might need to recalibrate and understand that, maybe we play the game better than them. But that's a whole nother conversation. But in terms of political power, we absolutely have to start snatching power away from these people who have no, I don't care how old they are. I don't care how black they are. I don't care how young they are. I don't care how cool of a Bernie bro they are. If they are not actually executing and using their power, then let's primary them and do everything that we can, because we can't just throw in the towel because the people who have our label, the people who wear our title are really Manchurian.
Well said. Ben Dixon, what time is the show every morning?
8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. So we're up early. It's your cup of coffee on your way to work. If you're an essential worker, we're out there with you.
Ben Dixon, always a pleasure. Thanks, man.
Pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Thanks, Ben.
Those cops, I mean,
one stat on those cops from Minneapolis. I guess the percentage of cops that live in the city of Minneapolis that patrol Minneapolis.
Right.
8%.
8%.
Like, I think you really need to look at, like, denazification in some of these. Like, I think I wouldn't be surprised if there's some very tremendous rot. And the type of people, I don't know. I've just seen the way people comment on, like, Minneapolis local news things on Facebook. And there's, like, some, like, just advanced dehumanization going on there. Yeah.
The urban-rural divide, I mean, I've mentioned this before. I don't know if it continues, but when I was in Cuba 20 years ago now, Castro would have all of the cops in Havana were recruited from the countryside so that there was some level of suspicion with the urban dwellers that was brought in. Very effective mechanism to sort of like make sure that the police see themselves as policing not their own community, but some type of other. Speaking of other, let's welcome our next guest. What's that? Do we have him? Ladies and gentlemen, you may know him from DavidCross.com. You may know him from Mr. Show. Or what's the poster that we have? I have a photograph in.
Yes, in the bathroom.
Yes.
Does he know that?
He may have forgotten that. Maybe we should grab that.
I don't think you always had it up there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had it stored somewhere.
Are you taking it down?
Well, he was on Arrested Development. Everybody knows that. But it was the increasingly bad decisions of Todd Margaret. Where is he? He also has dial-up internet. That is the problem. That has always been the problem with David Cross, is his dial-up internet. David, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Okay.
Are you? Can you tell me, with your crappy internet connection, do you know where this is from?
I'm sorry, Sam. I'm in Kuala Lumpur, and I'm at a cafe with my esports team. So things are – there's a bit of a lag. I'm sorry. I had one of those I don't know the term for it, but it's one of those eggs that they allow to sit out and rot. It's like boiled, but then it rots, and then you
– An old egg, I think they call it.
Yeah, that's the American – bastardization for it, but yeah, it's a delicacy here in Kuala Lumpur, and but my tastes are not quite as refined as they should be. How's it going?
Well, it's going fine. It doesn't seem like there's anybody else in that cafe. I mean, we can see some of the background. Are you the
it's
only?
It's a green screen. I brought a green screen of my actual office in Brooklyn.
And you you bring it to you. That's nice that they let you do that. You've lit it well.
Get up on the tower. Get on the tower. Do it from the tower. Sorry. What? I'm talking to one of my esports guys.
Oh, I see. So now you can't see this. Can you see this? Do you remember where I got this?
Yeah. It's a shitty framing job, that's for sure. But you should get your money back.
Well, I don't think I had it framed. It was I got it framed. I grabbed it framed.
Oh.
Remember where I got this from?
I don't. I'm going to guess, was it like some premiere party or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it hangs
very, very drunk at your premiere party, the show.
And stole it.
The next morning, I woke up and I had it in my bed, I think it was.
You slept with it?
I slept with it.
Well, you know, it hangs
that's
in our bathroom,
David. That's why
David.
The frame is all messed up.
Right. It hangs in our bathroom facing the toilet, David.
Facing the toilet?
Yes.
Meaning you've turned it, the picture,
of course.
Against the wall. I see. Okay.
So if one were to sit on the toilet, your face is...
Oh.
Scene.
Oh, to help
hypothetically
express the
mm-hmm.
the bowels. Okay,
it's an evacuation aid.
Mm-hmm.
David, what have you been doing these days? Oh, wait, you know, this is the other thing. There's news. You made you were in Variety the other day. Are you familiar with that magazine?
Variety Hollywood.
Yeah, Variety.
Wow. Magazine. What did I do this time? Did I say something naughty?
No, there was some story about you reuniting.
Oh, with Bob. Odenkirk. Yeah.
Do you remember Bob Odenkirk?
Vaguely, yeah.
And you're doing a series, a secret series that has been ongoing. Has it been ongoing? Have you been shooting it? What is it?
No. We're not even close to that. We're
all right, hold on.
What?
Hold on.
Is it my e-spot?
So the news is you're not even close to starting it. Is that right?
I wouldn't categorize it as news, but
well,
it is.
You don't worry. It's not your job to categorize it as news.
You're right.
Categorize
it. That is not my job. That's not my skill set.
Is anyone else aware that this thing has yet to begin shooting?
I think most people. I think people with who are cognizant and have good basic reading skills probably, if they saw it, would surmise that because it's in the body of the I wouldn't call it a report. It's like a two paragraph thing. But okay. Yeah, I think people.
So for the rest of the people.
Yeah. Yeah, Bob and I and his brother Bill are going
and
to.
Bill used to write for Mr. Show.
Yeah, wrote and produced, and the three of us are working on this limited series, like eight episode. And it's a story, you know, it's not sketches. It'll have a beginning, middle, and an end. And it's about a lot of stuff, but it kind of focuses on these two different cult leaders, one played by Bob, one played by myself, who kind of end up on each other's territory.
Mm.
At a small town in, we've yet to place it. It'll probably be California or New York, but a small town that's sort of overrun by these, all these different cults coming in.
Probably New York or California. I did not see that in the piece.
That is not in the piece. There's your breaking news, Sam.
Nailed it. So that's exciting.
Yeah, it is. It's a really fun idea, and it's just great to work with those guys again. And it's going to be fun at every stage. I believe it's going to be fun writing it. It's going to be fun performing it. It's going to be fun, you know, doing all the post on it. It's going to be really fun.
Let me ask you this, because this is the thing that's really changed about television in this country since, you know, the past 15 years or so, is that in some respects it's gotten a little bit more like it was in England, where I know you did. That's where you did your show.
I did two shows there.
You did two shows there.
Yeah.
The idea of limited series.
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit, because I don't know I don't know how conscious people are of that change and of the implications it is for folks like you in particular who write, act, produce.
It's a little different than limited series. The difference in the British model is you do quite often you do six episodes per series. So in the States, for commercial networks, you're doing anywhere from 18 to 22 episodes per season, which is over the course of a year. Whereas in, I think what you're referring to is they do like six episodes and they call it series one, series two, series three. So it's not necessarily because they don't have the, you know, they don't really have it much anymore in the States. The networks don't mean as much, but for a long time, since the inception of television, it was the season started in mid September and then you went to the summer and then they had reruns and it was a big deal to unveil your slate coming up in September, and that would run for the year. And, the British model doesn't have that.
But it impacts. It impacts the storytelling.
Yeah, for sure. You don't have to. The biggest difference is, kind of padding your story and artificially extending it to a place it might not necessarily go, so that you can have 22 episodes. And I'm talking about something where it's not just a standalone, like not a sitcom where, you know, it's all everything. There's a reset every episode, but a story where, you know, if a character breaks his leg, then he's going to have a broken leg for the next 7, 8, 9 episodes, depending on the time span. You know what I mean? Just things. If there's a couple going through a divorce, that has to, you know.
Well, that's what's changed, I think, like comedy in is that you now have the ability to do. I mean, because we saw sort of narrative stories like that in drama to some extent. I mean, but you'd still have to have a more or less a reset on some level. You know, you'd get soap operas sometimes that would, you know, like Dallas, but you wouldn't see comedies that had a narrative arc. It was always like, next week, it's as if nothing had happened the week before, practically. Maybe somebody would shift a job or something like that.
There is an early one that was really groundbreaking that did that, called Soap. And it was really way ahead of its time, really clever. This would have been in the 70s, I think.
Yep, Billy Crystal and who else? Gosh,
Richard Mulligan, Billy Crystal, Catherine, I can't remember her name, Jay Johnson, a ventriloquist. Gosh, who else is in there?
Oh, right, that ventriloquist dude.
Yeah, but it was really, it was like a... So they did that thing where there was like, it was a soap opera, but it was a primetime comedy, way, way ahead of its time. But as far as like, yeah, storytelling, you just don't have to artificially pad it. And you could tell a story beginning, middle, and end, and that'll be that. You're done. That's, you know, we needed no more and no less episodes to tell this story.
Let's talk a little bit about your special that's coming up too, because this is also like a relatively, I mean, I guess it's been like 4 or 5 years where comedians have started to do this, but release on your own type of situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wish I'd done it sooner, to be honest.
Yeah, me too.
Why are you upset that I,
it's just taking you a long time to get on the ball with this. And a lot of people have been complaining about it to me.
Really complaining.
Yeah. It's weird.
You'd categorize it as complaining when they mentioned it. It was always in that, it felt like a complaint.
Like, why is he doing this? Why isn't he doing this? When's this coming out? Why is David doing his own thing?
Why don't you tip off David to this?
Yeah, I didn't want to harass you with it. I didn't want to. Okay. I thought maybe it was best not to press.
But it sounds like, just from listening to this, it sounds like the people that were complaining were like elderly Jews in a retirement home.
I mean, them mostly. Mostly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. They're
mostly like my parents and their friends who were complaining about it a little bit. It's coming out on February 12th.
February 12th on my website, officialdavidcross.com.
Officialdavidcross.com. Did someone else get davidcross.com?
I think so, yeah. That's why I had to do it. Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah. Officialdavidcross.com.
You know what I'm doing right now, right?
Writing it down?
No, going to davidcross.com.
Oh, yeah, let me know. Oh, you know what? There's a violinist who played with King Crimson, so he might have been the
Well, the first he's not one. Doing anything with it. Maybe you should talk to him.
Get it. Okay. We'll have him.
My parents and their friends have been complaining about that, too. Yeah. Every time I go there to davidcross.com, I don't see I don't see him.
Makes sense.
Okay, so the official davidcross.com, and what happens? Live?
No, well, there's a live stream premiere, and I'm doing Q&A after it and all that stuff. But it's like a lot of these guys who do this, or people who do it. There's, you go and you get a ticket, and then you can watch it anytime. I think you have 2 weeks to watch it, and but you'll be able to purchase the ticket whenever you want.
Why just 2 weeks?
That's what the guys who do this and do it for other people said. That's a good, it's the right number. I don't know. I don't know. That's not my, forte or my, I don't know. They're the same people who told me to make it official David Cross. So who knows?
Maybe I don't know who you're listening to these days. I'm not sure I would go for that, but that's fine. And when did you record it?
Well, that's the other great thing about releasing it myself is I recorded it 3 months ago in November at the Bell House in Brooklyn, and turning it around. And like when I went to shop it around, you know, people are like, well, we've got everything. We're backlogged and we can put it on at the third quarter of 2022 and this is back, you know, in 2021 when I was like, and it won.
Q4 of 2021.
Sure. I think even Netflix said 2023 is when I'm like, no, that's not going to do it. So, I own it. I have full control. I own it in perpetuity and it's great. I wish I had done that sooner. I really do. And it doesn't get lost to an algorithm. That's the other great thing.
Yeah.
If you want to, like
those Netflix things too, they escape the public consciousness so quickly. Like people binge it and they're on their phone, yeah. Or whatever. It's less conscious.
Well, even more than that, if it's not part of your algorithm or part of what the machine's algorithm is saying it is, then you'll never even know about it unless mm-hmm. you actually go search it out. So, you know.
I was watching Station 11, and then I saw you on it.
Yeah, I watched it.
You know that you were on that program?
I found out through Variety. I subscribe to Variety. I have an alert, varietyhollywood.com, internet, NGO. I shot it. My contribution was fairly minimal, and I was in and out relatively quickly for that kind of a expansive show. And I knew a little bit about it. I didn't know I had not read the book. I'd read a couple scripts, and Patrick Somerville, the showrunner writer, was really great about filling me in on stuff. But until I sat down and watched it, I didn't know how expansive, and I was really impressed. I really, really, really enjoyed it, and it's my kind of storytelling. That kind of jumping around and dropping clues here and there, and it rewards an attentive viewer. And I loved what it had to say about art and human relationships, and I really, really, really enjoyed it more than I expected to. I expected to enjoy it, but it's probably, as far as that kind of limited series drama, that was probably the best thing I've seen all year in the last year.
I got to tell you, I also really enjoyed it. Now, did you have to go and read about Shakespeare before you did that show?
I was somewhat familiar with, first of all, I learned how to pronounce his name correctly. I'd always called him Shakespeare, and thought he was an African warrior, and so I was corrected on that. But
was that a funny moment when you came on?
It was a little awkward. But I covered by pretending that I was illiterate, so that helped. And then I shit myself and ran away. And then people just felt sorry for me. And I said I was dehydrated. I had a publicist say I was dehydrated. I flew in a publicist to the set and had them say, hired them just for an hour, had them say I was dehydrated, fired them, sent them back. And then I came out. And everybody was cool.
And who was it that told you? Was it your? I mean, who was it that told you how to pronounce Shakespeare properly? That must have been
that's what made it weird, because it was shooting in Toronto, and I was in Toronto at the time, and Doug Ford, who is the premier of Ontario, ran as soon as he heard that. He ran. It was about 19 kilometers from where he was, and he's not in the best shape, and. He ran over and he was huffing and puffing and had one of those oxygen tanks like you see in the sidelines of a football game. And he came in. It took him like a good 10 minutes to catch his breath going, it's not Shakespeare, whatever. And then he segued off, his assistant was on a segue and he knocked his assistant off, got on the segue and took off. Went back to where he was and outside of Toronto.
So at least he didn't have to run home, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
What did you shoot during? Obviously, you shot that during COVID, right? I mean, during the pandemic.
Yeah.
What's the procedures that you have on there? Everybody coming in testing every day? How many people?
Yeah,
got
it's screwed? Pretty well. I shot a couple things during the pandemic. I finished. Genius, which was a thing I did for the Aretha Franklin thing, and we were halfway through the second to last episode when we got shut down, and we were shut down for quite a while. And then there's COVID protocols. Each company, has their own protocols, and They're all pretty similar. They're very, very, very strict. For both of those things, I shot four things over COVID, but you get tested every other day. And sometimes even if you're not working for, 5 days, you still have to drive to set, go to the nurse's tent, get tested, and go back home, and they give you the results and 24 hours later. And so you're tested every other day. And when you get to set, there are four zones. There's zone A, B, C, D, and people who are assigned to those zones cannot interact. And then there's no more craft services. There's no more eating lunch like it was. Your chairs are, if not 6 feet apart, there's dividers. Everybody has a mask, or if you're on camera, you have one of those face shields so it doesn't fuck up your hair and stuff. So you have face shield. Everybody has a mask and a face shield. Who's not working on that stuff, you go rehearse with all your stuff on. Then they go to shoot. Then they take all your stuff. And there's a COVID. Each production I did had, I don't know exactly where they were from, but they were outside of the studio, outside of the production, and they were just there to make sure that the regulations were being followed. Every single one I did, and then they come and they collect your face shields, and you got your name on it and tape, and then you shoot the scene, and then shields back on, and then that's so there. It's quite different. There's not a lot of hanging out,
And I sort of feel like that would it would create an even heightened sense. I mean, so people, you sit around the set for so long, and then you go in and you have this very sort of intense period of time where you're actually on camera. I would imagine it would sort of even heighten that, just the idea that you're out there and you're sort of in, because in some level you're sort of transported in time to a time where there's no COVID, right? As you're in that scene.
Yeah. I mean, it's in a sense, you don't really think about it that way. And it's probably subconsciously freeing in a sense. So it makes you even freer in that scene, cause you're happy to not have the mask on, the face shield and all that. And you get to be close to somebody physically, close to somebody, and in ways that you don't think about. You're like, oh, I haven't done that in a long time. I haven't sat. We had I did two shows where there was, three. With nervous eating. There's in Station 11 where there's a big table and we're eating, and it's like, boy, I haven't done that outside of just with my wife and my daughter. I haven't done that in a long time. Been at a big long table with people serving drinks, and it's been quite a while.
That's sort of fun.
Sort of.
All right. big sets. Who would you say was the worst person?
That's your segue. Okay, so big sets.
I should just say, Myla, at one point, and I think we've played it on this show, interviewed you here on set.
A long time.
Yeah, many years ago, when she saw you in Pitch Perfect, I think it was, or something like that. Is that what it was?
I know him from Kung Fu Panda.
There you go.
That's
same with my daughter.
Not actually.
And Myla asked you some question that was who did you not like on the set? And I always thought that was a great question. You danced around it a little bit.
And what was which was the production?
What was the production? It was Pitch Perfect.
Oh.
And there was somebody, you sort of implied there was somebody there.
There was somebody that I did not jibe with.
Yeah.
Who didn't roll with improv.
Yeah, she called it out. Why don't you tell us now? It's been a long time. I think you could tell us.
I'm not going to, because it wasn't egregious behavior. If somebody is acting shitty, because this person wasn't shitty. it just was a surprise that there was, I was surprised at the self-consciousness that like it just stopped scenes when there'd be like, you know what I mean? And everyone else was rolling with it. Which happens, you know, most...
They're a comedian, or a comedic act, and... Yeah.
Right. All right, can you give us a hint?
yes, really they were in the scene that I was doing. So if you go watch the movie, and you go see the scene I was doing, it was somebody that was in the scene with me.
Wow.
Yeah, I had a similar experience with Chris Noth. I'm willing to tell that in a...
Oh, Chris Noth was kind of a dick. He was... He was really...
was he in that movie, too?
No. Oh. No, I did a... it was one of the oddest things I've ever done, and I did it for the experience, like, what the fuck? Let's see what this is like. It's so outside of my wheelhouse. But I did a, you know, Law and Order, whatever that one was that he's on,
right.
A Law and Order thing. And the other people were really great. Really, really. What was her name? Julianne Nichols. She was great. She was awesome. I don't want to say he was like mean or belittling but he was very, it's hard to describe. But one thing he did was, We were doing this thing, and it was like a dramatic thing where he has to grab me, and he's a big guy, and he would grab me, and he was like really like any trained actor knows you don't have to really do that stuff. That's like rookie shit, and he's leaving bruises and stuff, and I've got like outerwear, and like no one's gonna see it, and like what. Dude, lighten up. I will act. I'll give you that you're grabbing me. You don't have to really, you know, throw me into that wall. I mean, come on, what the fuck are you doing? You're a professional. And that was really odd. And that like kind of irritated him. And he just wasn't, he wasn't like the most fun guy to work with.
No, no.
It'd be wrong to say he was an asshole, but he was just not a good, not pleasant, you know.
My experience with him, he was an asshole. But let's have one Jim Belushi story, because I don't know if we've ever talked on.
Sam, I've done that. It's in the book. I've done. There's all. I've talked about it and written about it. Yeah, it just that's old stuff.
Okay. Chris Noth, Jim Belushi. What's
the, what are you? Why are you on this Real Housewives? Let's diss on everybody kick right now.
I don't know. I just sort of fell into it. Why? You want to say something nice about somebody?
He wants to create a headline to talk.
Yeah, I'm trying to break some news.
I see. I've worked with I'd say the vast majority of people I've worked with have been great and good. Nobody wants to hear that.
Wait a second. Say that again. All right. Well, let's talk. So the show's on the 12th, and I'm from the future. What's that about?
That's the name of the special.
Right.
And like the last special.
Do you really think you are?
Well, you're going to have to watch the special and find out. Like the last special, it was I had a kind of a handful of show title. It was going to be a tour first, and I had to cancel the tour. But it was going to be a handful of tour titles, and they were either too pretentious or too stupid and punny. And somebody suggested, because it's a line from the set. There's it's a line for the set. And then somebody that the special before that, Oh, Come On, it was the same thing happened. I like listed my, what do you think of this for a title? And the people were like, no, that's terrible. And, you know, I ran a list of like five or six ideas. And then somebody from the audience shouted out, what about Oh, Come On? I was like, boom, great, perfect.
Oh, wait, so people in the audience named your
Oh, Come On, and I'm from the future. Yep.
Whoa. And yeah. Then do you send these people royalties or do you?
I pay their rent for 6 months and do a little bit of lawn work, any kind of maintenance around the house during those 6 months. There's some things I won't do, but most things I'll do. I'll do cleaning and do some gutter work and things like that.
What won't you do?
I won't prime a wall to be painted. I'll paint it. I will not prime it.
Right. That's classic. Typical.
Classic cross.
So predictable. David Cross, you're from the future. And you could, people can go and they, oh, you can buy now. What is it saying? You can buy.
You can reserve a ticket. Yeah, you can buy now for the 12th or any time after that. Yeah, you can get your ticket.
Well, it says buy now and watch any time through February 22nd. You can't buy. You can't watch it now, can you?
No, you cannot. You can't. Maybe. What are you looking at?
I'm looking at your website.
Hmm. That shouldn't. It should not say watch anytime because the it doesn't premiere until the 12th. We're doing a live stream thing with a Q&A. So that is incorrect. Unless, wait a second, are you going off the link I sent you?
A lie.
Is it the link that I sent you, Sam?
I'm an official David Cross, and okay. In red, can we pop this up, please, on the
yeah,
screen?
Yeah, do. Because that would legitimately be a mistake.
Yeah, scroll down. No, not I'm in from the future. Go to David Cross, officialdavidcross.com. Right there. Go to scroll down. Yeah. Scroll. See that in red? What does it say?
Yeah, you're right.
Get
yeah,
it.
You're right. I gotta.
Finally did it. Finally did it. I knew if I had you on the line long enough, I would break some news. And there it is. David Cross caught in a lie. Having to backtrack off of his promise on the official David Cross.
I'm reading it, and it's really poorly worded because it says David Lane special
scrambling around. This is like worse than you should call the same PR guy you had with the Shakespeare or whatever it was, because this
Jack is Spiari.
This is you got nailed.
I get nailed to the cross.
You can save that one for the next show. Yep. Which, incidentally, if you go to davidcross.com/nailedtothecross, you can buy it and watch it now too, even though it's not even been shot, apparently.
No. Yep.
David Cross, thank you so much for joining us. Folks can head over to Official David Cross and try and figure out what the hell is going on with this special that supposedly premieres February 12th at 5 or 8 p.m. Eastern, but apparently is also available now.
Crazy.
Crazy, crazy stuff.
Well, that's thanks. Some good investigative journalism there, Sam. And
thank
I
you,
appreciate
David.
It.
I appreciate it.
And way to stick it to the man. I love what you do. I love what you do on your show. Sticking it to the man.
Stuck it to you.
Yep. Oh, all I'm right. The man. Okay, great.
Yep. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. I have to do another podcast now.
Seriously?
Yeah. Which I one? Do have to go. Hey, there's
I'm
cold.
We've got to go. Bye-bye. super uncomfortable. Mm. That guy. Yeah. Super uncomfortable.
Fine. You can sense the tension.
You know,
you too.
It was just a matter of time before his whole sort of web of lies were exploded. And
he kept pressing.
It's like Theranos yeah. all over again.
Yeah. Right. Yep. Sorry, I had to. Had to be the one to crush people's perspective about David Cross, but there it is.
What was the perspective?
That he's not a blatant liar.
Oh.
And, you know, the thing is, when you say official David Cross, it's you're sort of doubling down on stuff.
Right, right. They're giving yourself legitimacy.
Yeah. You're saying, like, this is the official thing. It's not, I'm dehydrated or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. It's official. I guess we're going to do a
Freebie
Friday. Yeah.
Cool.
We got 30 minutes left. And
What's your encounter with celebrities that have used dehydration as their excuse? When
just about everyone.
Pretty much
every one of them.
I did like when that guy from Entourage used mercury poisoning. That was like a new one. What's his name?
I don't know. For what? What did he? What was he apologizing?
He got out of a play that he was doing, and he said he had mercury poisoning.
Oh, Jeremy Piven.
Yeah. Oh, what, did Piven say that?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's nuts. I'm trying to think of like what excuses Busey used. Busey was always like would say it was his car accident, but there were other factors.
Well.
Depending on the day.
Yeah, I mean, you've been clear about that.
Yeah, I think you've been, fairly explicit that there were... Well, I haven't been... I don't want to be fairly explicit. I want to be vaguely explicit. People can take supplements that will sometimes affect your behavior and mood.
Oh.
And he would take... I think my suspicion was that there were supplements.
Right, and vitamins.
Well...
Oh.
I'm not sure I would call them vitamins.
Well, some people do.
Some people might, but these were not, my sense was that they were not officially, vitamins. Let's go with, should we do some, should we do a clip? Which of these should we do? This is, oh, these lunatics.
God, really, Enes Kanter just can't get off television.
What is the death totals yesterday?
2,632 people died yesterday.
2,632 people died in this country yesterday. Again, lagging indicator. The infection rate of Omicron, as a nation, is going down. There are locations where it is not. And we're going to see this in places where Omicron is yet to hit. Over time, it's going to go up. Yet, Ben Shapiro, who has wanted to justify not protecting the people who work for his company, Ben Shapiro wants people to get back to work regardless of what's going on. Here's the irony, is that these guys both want workers to go back to work and also probably upset that the employment numbers are better. But
I just said bless you to myself.
Here is bless you. Here is Ben Shapiro talking about the state of the Omicron COVID variant. This is clip number 7.
Experts had suggested we were going to gain about 200,000 jobs in January. So that means they missed by 500,000 jobs because they went the wrong direction in January. The U.S. added just 199,000 jobs in December. Economists are bracing for overall job losses in January. They expect the labor market to bounce back as Omicron fades, but we keep hearing that over and over. See, the thing is, you actually have to let Omicron fade if Omicron is going to fade. Because at this point, Omicron is just a mental condition. Omicron is not even a tremendous physical threat to the American people at this point because cases have been declining so steeply. And by the way, pretty much everybody has either been vaxxed or had natural immunity at this point by the stats. But it doesn't matter. You keep treating it as a crisis.
Okay. It's hard to sort of list the number of things he gets wrong in that clip because it's so densely packed with idiocy that it's hard to sort of parse out.
That's kind of his thing.
We know that approximately 20% of the people who are dying on a daily basis, at least this was the case a week or two ago, are vaccinated. They may be double vaccinated. Don't know because we just don't have enough data in terms of vaccinated, meaning 2 or 3 vaccinations, boosted. There are breakthrough things. Yes, most of those people probably older than him, probably his parents' age. I don't know if they're alive. I suspect if they are alive, he'd want to keep them alive. But nevertheless, we also know that 2,600 people died on the day that he said that. Probably the vast majority of them, Omicron. Mm-hmm. Maybe some have Delta. We just don't quite have all the data on that as well. is no letting Omicron go away.
Well, his metric for why, like, is that infections are going down, but he can't say that deaths are going down because those numbers are still climbing.
Exactly.
And they're as stark as any time in this pandemic.
It's interesting how he chooses to talk about the case count.
It's also interesting how he chooses to talk about a virus as if, like, you know, like, well, the reason why people are getting wet when they go outside is because there's not enough people ignoring the rain.
Also, the natural immunity point, like, there is no way to actually track natural immunity. There's a very distinct possibility that if you got COVID, you can get COVID again via natural immunity. We don't know how long it lasts. It's very different person to person, it seems to be. And it's also different with the variants that you might have contracted. So, like, the idea that he's coming out and saying that natural immunity is a substitute protection for COVID via, like, pairing it with vaccinations, it's absurd.
And he also was wrong about what was happening. His whole piece there was premised on that the job numbers were going to be anemic in January because people are not ignoring Omicron enough, and so Omicron is not going away. And the numbers were close to 500,000 new jobs in January. And what that suggests is that people were far more nervous about Omicron in December because, and we can see the lagging indicator, you've got 2,600 people dying a day right now. Those are people who contracted it in December.
Yeah.
And maybe the beginning of January.
That's why you have people like Nate Silver saying they're going to patriotically go out to eat more often to try to get the economy back. But it's like you can't make up for the fact that everybody else is still concerned about the virus that's flying around and clogging up hospitals.
There's a lot so of people. Brave of you to go and have a filet mignon.
Well, I mean, and it's also sort of like, you know, there's also people who like may have someone in their life who is in some way immunocompromised. I mean, and the idea that you should be cavalier about this or decide that, you know what, it's more important for me to go out and support restaurants than it is for me to hang out with my mom or my dad or my uncle or my aunt or my friend or my child.
Not just that it's more important, that I'm actually benevolent.
Yes, I'm actually a good person and I'm a rational person because I'm making that decision. It's just bizarre. And
they want to do what they want to do, and so then they like assign valor to it. It's so like absurdly narcissistic. You want to go out to dinner? Go out to dinner. Let's not pretend like you're doing some amazing act of kindness. It's ridiculous.
And if you're an apologist for capitalism, it's a lot easier to say like this is all in people's head than actually we have a structural problem with our consumer economy,
right?
And it's not exactly as robust as we need it to be.
All right, let's, Sean Hannity, welcome to his program, bastion of wealth of knowledge, and the very, very handsome Adam Carolla to his program last night for some of Adam Carolla's wisdom about women and what makes a politician popular. Here is Sean Hannity and Adam Carolla.
And here's a quick thought experiment. If AOC was fat and in her 60s, would anyone listen to another thing she ever said?
Oh, boy. You're going to step in that one. What exactly do you mean by that? Do you mean, is it because she's young and what?
Yes, she's young, she's vibrant, she's beautiful, and everyone's always putting a camera and a mic in her face. But her opinions are idiotic 95% of the time. And I don't think if she was a middle-aged, heavy-set woman, anyone would care what she had to say.
I'm not so sure I agree. Now, I will say this.
You've got to run away from that.
Criticize her ideas, and I do. I think the Green New Deal is madness and insanity, but she's got the whole Democratic Party following her. In my opinion, she's way more powerful than Speaker Pelosi. And if she and the squad decide Speaker Pelosi's out, I think she could probably be Speaker. If she challenges Chuck Schumer in New York, I think she has a good shot of beating him. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I agree with you. I'm just saying if she was fat and old, I don't think TMZ would be chasing her around.
Pause it for one second. Pause it for one second. This is an interesting way. No, no, no. Keep that image up there because this is an interesting way to test his theory.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine if there was someone who was really old, let's say, and not necessarily the best looking person to look at? Who would espouse their views? Do you really think that people would listen to that person or they would be popular in any way?
Constantly on the news.
Could they run and challenge maybe like the top politicians in the Democratic Party for, let's say, president? Or I don't know. Do you think they could get made to chairperson of the banking committee in the Senate? Oh, who's that next? To AOC.
Who's that hot piece of ass next to AOC?
What a smoke show.
Whoa.
I mean, all right, like.
Or let's say, like you know, Katie Porter is not middle-aged, but she sort of, she has that look of like, she could be like 28 or 58.
Okay.
Like, I have friends who look like that. They look the same. When we were like in our 20s, I'm like, you look like you're like 42. And then when they're like 58, I'm like, you still look like you're 42. Katie Porter still looks like that.
Yeah.
She is also one of the most popular Democratic politicians that exist.
But it's the point really, though, is that they're telling on themselves here. I mean, that's why they're obsessed with her, is because they have a weird, they have a psychosexual obsession with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They can't understand why she's saying all these things that makes them mad, but she's still too attractive to them. And like, it's very predatory and creepy.
I imagine, because it was certainly the case a year ago, that AOC still has higher name recognition amongst Republicans than she does amongst Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a function of exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And Sean Hannity, if he wasn't so sensitive to the fact that no women listen to his show, which he has been for 20 years, probably would have been more comfortable going there. But the idea that AOC has the ability to get rid of Nancy Pelosi also, it's like,
I wish.
It's like, absolutely. Absolutely. It is like just two idiots just jousting with their idiocy. And like, well, I see your idiocy. I will raise your idiocy with my own idiocy.
They're so arrested too, because, or, I mean, specifically Corolla in this instance, because they just like, they're like, they're in elementary school or something like that.
That's,
like, I'm going to pull on
Corolla's entire,
I'm going to pull on the girl's ponytail
because
I like,
because
I think she's cute.
Yeah.
And I mean, honestly, they're so out of touch with their own, like, and disconnected from their own, like, sexuality, that they project all of their anger onto her. And it's just, it's really creepy. And it's at the root of, like, why someone like her does get harassed to a degree because the right wing pushes it, than someone like Katie Porter does not.
They love at Fox, and they have loved this since the beginning of their, since their inception, is attacking left-leaning young women.
Yeah.
It has been their recipe since at least the year 2000.
And when you bring up Bernie in contrast, too, that is exactly it, right? I mean, on the left, and people in the Democratic Party, I mean, I would say on the left, we both appreciate and like Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but the people who are obsessed with and driving this only focus on one of them, independent of what they're both saying, even though they're more ideologically aligned. So that's it's their projection.
That sort of like sexualizing of it too, it reminds me of Nixon in 1950 called his opponent Helen Douglas pink right down to her underwear, and it's like, you're invoking this stuff for a reason, and it says a lot about, as much about you as it does the person you're ostensibly talking about.
Yeah.
Let's go to the IMs. Damien says, Matt Chrisman had said something once that the reason why that Republicans have such a hard time dealing with AOC is that Fox News has been crossing the politics part of their brains with the sex parts of their brains for years to gain viewers, and now it's backfiring on them.
Yeah.
Let's see here.
I mean, and it's also like they used to make comments about Hillary Clinton's attractiveness all the time, too. And her outfits and her pantsuits. And I mean, that was, it's just sexism.
Is
a woman fuckable or is she not?
Right. Kendrick Lamar.
God, that's funny. Do you know who Kendrick Lamar is?
No. What?
Yeah.
Kendrick Lamar is a rapper.
He's a very good one.
Charlie Beta Delta. That's the Sebede. M, about your COVID QR.
Like calling me M?
Maybe.
Only my really close friends do, but all right. Maybe it's
COVID QR napkin tweet. As I understand it, this was a thing places started doing back when we were still spraying our grocery bags with Lysol and wiping down things when we weren't very sure how it spread exactly, how airborne it is, etc.
I really can't stand these QR code menus. Like I had dinner with a friend last night, and it's just like I find it to be perplexing that it's not really it's not transmitted by touch. So I don't know why we're doing that, but basically I think I think it goes deeper when it comes to like a coffee shop. Like coffee shops says we're cashless. That's so they can keep homeless people out.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Any anti-cash stuff is all anti.
I hate it. And then like I mean all this QR code stuff too. We were talking about. I watched when I was getting COVID tested. There was an older couple who couldn't figure it out. It's the same thing when Kamala Harris said, "Just Google it. Google your COVID testing facility." There is just like an elitism to it, or like a disregard for people who may not have smartphones or may not have credit cards. It's just, I don't like that transition. So I tweeted like, why are we still doing this? But I think it's just really so restaurants can save money at this point.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're not going to bring back menus. I don't think so. I think that's one of the things that are really going to have durability on some level.
That in Title 42, it looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good point.
Let's talk about this. And I think we're going to be talking about Yemen and other issues next week. But at the moment, there are, and I don't think anybody, I haven't seen anybody say anything other or even contradict the idea that there are over 100,000 Russian troops that have amassed on the border of Ukraine. And supposedly there may be, you know, more being added. And my understanding is that the ground gets harder as it gets colder in February, and that is the optimal time for a ground invasion would come over the course of the next 3 or 4 weeks. The U.S. has now deployed troops, I think, to places like Estonia. Not many.
Can I just ask a really stupid question? Why does the ground being harder have anything to do with it?
You got heavy equipment.
Okay,
you've got
so it
tanks.
Doesn't sink.
You've
okay,
got
gotcha.
You've got personnel transport. Maybe you want to land planes in okay. certain areas. You want the ground to be hard. Makes it much easier. And this is a reality. Nobody knows whether Putin finds it in his interest to invade Ukraine. Regardless of who you perceive Ukraine to be, I don't think there's anybody who wants civilian deaths in a war. You shouldn't. You should want there to not be a war. And I believe that Russia has reason to be concerned about Ukraine going into NATO. And I believe it was a mistake for George W. Bush to promise Ukraine that they could have membership into NATO on behalf of the United States of America. And I also believe that from president to president, for the most part, the U.S., particularly in the context of foreign policy, should show the world that there's some measure of consistency. Now, I obviously feel consistency is not as important when you are changing policy to what I consider to be better. But broadly speaking, when we enter treaties or agreements, I think it's better for the United States to maintain those. But I, for one, frankly, think that NATO should begin to, you know, wrap things up a little bit. It may be in a long process, and maybe different ways of doing that. And if Joe Biden can figure out a way of sort of starting to step back from that promise, that would be good. So, you know, there is legitimate Russian concerns here, but there's nothing urgent that's going on. NATO admission is not imminent. And so I think, in my sense, is the Biden administration, they can't possibly want a Russian incursion into Ukraine, and they can't possibly want to have a conflict with Russia. There may be interests that are, you know, oil interests that are maybe don't want certain pipelines to go through, or Europe to become dependent on Russian energy, et cetera, et cetera. So here is, and a lot's been made of this exchange. AP writer Matt Lee and State Department Press Secretary Ned Price. I don't think Ned Price is doing the administration any favors here. But I also don't think that this claim made by the United States is as problematic as some seem to think it is. Play this clip.
Quite a mouthful there. So you said actions such as these suggest otherwise, suggest meaning.
Pause it for 1 second. I should just say, just to set this up, the United States, via Ned Price, I think, announces that they have, I don't know, some type of video evidence, or they claim that videos were being made.
Intelligence that a video might be produced.
Said a video might be produced, which essentially shows a false flag operation in Ukraine. It sounds a little fantastical to me, like other claims of false flags have at times, but, you know, remember the Maine. And it's not just the Maine, the Gulf of Tonkin. I mean, we've certainly done it. I wouldn't put it past anybody else to do it. And they make the claim. Do they offer any evidence that there's a video being made? The answer is no.
Right. And this is the same reporter, I believe, that we played yesterday, right? Matt Lee, who consistently gets into these spars from the AP with Ned Price. Anyway.
I'm not convinced that either one of them is in the right here, but go ahead.
Quite a mouthful there. So you said actions such as these suggest otherwise, suggest meaning that they suggest they're not interested in talks and they're going to go ahead with some kind of a... What action are you talking about?
One, the actions I've just pointed to. The fact that Russia continues to engage in disinformation.
You've made an allegation that they might do that. Have they actually done it?
What we know, Matt, is what I have just said, that they have engaged in this activity, in this planning activity.
Because
obviously this is not the first time we've made these reports public. You'll remember that just a few weeks ago.
I'm sorry, made what report public?
If you'll let me finish, I will tell you what report we made public. We told you a few weeks ago that we have information indicating Russia also has already prepositioned a group of operatives to conduct a false flag operation in eastern Ukraine. So that, Matt, to your question, is an action that Russia has already taken.
It's an action that you say that they have taken, but you have shown no evidence to confirm that. And I'm going to get to the next question here, which is, What is the evidence that they... I mean, this is like crisis actors, really? This is like Alex Jones territory you're getting into now. What evidence do you have to support the idea that there is some propaganda film in the making?
Matt, this is derived from information known to the U.S. government, intelligence information that we have declassified. I think you know...
Okay, well, where is it? Where is this information?
It is intelligence information that we have declassified.
Well, where is it? Where is the declassified information?
I just delivered it.
No, you made a series of allegations and statements.
Would you like us to print it out, the topper? Because you will see a transcript of this briefing that you can print out for yourself.
That's not evidence, Ned. That's you saying it. That's not evidence. I'm sorry.
What would you like, Matt?
I would like to see some proof that you can show that
Matt, you have been
that shows that the Russians are doing it. Ned, I've been doing this for a long time.
I know that was my point. You have been doing this for quite a while. You know that when we declassify intelligence information, we do so in a means. We do so. We do so with an eye to protecting sources and methods.
Kabul is not going to fall. I remember a lot of things. So where is the declassified information other than you coming out here and saying?
Matt, I'm sorry you don't like the format, but we have
declassified format. It's the content.
I'm sorry you don't like the content. I'm sorry you are doubting the information that is in the possession of the U.S. government.
No,
what I'm telling you is that this is information that's available to us. We are making it available to you in order for a couple reasons. One is to attempt to deter the Russians from going ahead with this activity.
Are you skeptical of what Matt Lee's saying there?
I'm not skeptical of what Matt Lee's saying there in terms of, like, they have provided no evidence for this claim whatsoever. And there's without a doubt, and he should be skeptical of the claim. But if I'm the Ned Price, my answer would be fine. Be skeptical. We cannot provide you evidence of what we know because we don't want to compromise our sources. But it is fine for you to be skeptical of it. We are only informing the public of what we know, so that in the event that something like that happens, it cannot be used as a pretext for war. And if it doesn't happen, then fine. And I mean, in that regard, what I find ridiculous is that there's some expectation that people should believe it necessarily because it's been released by the U.S. government.
Right.
I agree. At the same time, in terms of someone who doesn't want to see any war, they should have just said, we're releasing this information. We cannot substantiate it because of, you could say, we can't substantiate it because it's, you know, it's more than a rumor, but we can't provide the evidence without compromising our resources. So if people are skeptical about it, that's fine. That's okay. We just want to put it out there because we're aware of this. And so if you see something like this that it develops, understand that it's not a spontaneous thing that's happened, that we're aware of plans that have been in the process. And you, mission accomplished.
But to me, the fact that he's not being more specific about the content means that there is not substantial evidence for it.
Well, I'll take, but
here's the thing. I don't care because it's not an actionable claim. There's nothing. If you have proof or no proof that the Russians are making a video about something that doesn't happen, that you can't go to war over that.
I agree.
And so it's not an actionable claim. So as far as I'm concerned, this is a failure on the State Department to just come out and instead of having to sort of like tell people, you got to believe us because we have no, it's just simply say, like, we're just interested in putting down the marker. So if this happens, understand it's not a legitimate reason for Russia to invade.
Yeah.
And that's all you need to do.
I think there's that. And I will take some exception to the format, though, which is that when Price says this is information in the custody of the United States government, why is it only the United States government? Why isn't also France or Germany maybe leading with this info? Like, I think it's like that stuff. Our sources, methods, intelligence does not have the credibility to do this on its own.
And that's what Lee understands. He's been doing this for decades. And so this has been, this is like the... sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I mean, that is the underbelly of, like, his skepticism here is because he was questioning the Bush administration on a lot of this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think it's perfectly legitimate for reporters to say, like, where's the evidence here? I just think that, like, the State Department should have had their shit together better and say, we can't provide you evidence. And it's frankly, it's not an actionable claim.
Right. If it's not used for pretext for sanctions or U.S. invasion.
Without
right?
a doubt. You can't sanction somebody because they're making videos.
Right.
Like, are you kidding me? Like, all right, continue with the deterrence, because he says, go back just a little bit and finish and keep going with this clip, because this is what they should have led with. We are announcing this not because we can prove it, not because we're in a position to substantiate it, but rather we announce it because we have this information.
I don't think do they have the information though, Sam? Like, do they have the information?
I think
this is just seems let me put bullshit this way. About let's, like, let's Russian say, disinformation. Let's say,
well, but I mean, they're being pretty specific about what they've.
I don't know.
Released.
I mean,
well, they said. I mean, if you look at the New York Times story, it says. I mean, this is this is a claim that you couldn't. Like I say, it's not actionable. You can't. You have sanctions because they're making a fake video.
I mean, I'll just take it back to the Germany. My problem with this whole thing is America seems more gung ho about this than the actual Europeans do. And so, like, I think there's certain, like, Germany's banned RT recently after being more hesitant to, like, arm Ukraine than the states were. And I think, like, yeah, there could be something expected from a propaganda warfare from Russia. I think that's not beyond the realm of possibility.
I agree, but I mean,
I think the problem is, like, the United States and the Western intelligence, or that's the Brits, I'm sorry, that dog doesn't hunt.
All right, so this, the plan, which the United States hopes to spoil by making public, I mean, involves staging and filming a fabricated attack by the Ukrainian military, either on Russian territory against Russian-speaking people in eastern Ukraine. Russia, the official said, intended to use the video to accuse Ukraine of genocide against Russian-speaking people. It would then use the outrage over the video to justify an attack or have separatist leaders in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine invite a Russian intervention. Officials would not release any direct evidence of the plan or specify how they learned of it, saying so would compromise source and methods. But the plan that they're talking about, and here's, the video was intended to be elaborate, officials said, with plans for graphic images of the staged, corpse-strewn aftermath of an explosion and footage of destroyed locations. They said the video was also set to include fake Ukrainian military equipment, Turkish-made drones, and actors playing Russian-speaking mourners. Now, I don't know if this is...
It is specific, but...
It's fairly specific, and the value of this, to me... I don't know how anybody could think that, like, oh, we've made this claim, therefore we're going to sanction Russia, or therefore we're going to invade, provide more weapons for Ukraine. No, it is a way of basically saying that if a video like this comes out, it should be treated with skepticism. And by getting that information out there, even if it is like they have 3% assuredness about it, in my mind, if you're interested in there not being a war and people not being killed by weapons, this is a good thing to put out there. You just need to be frank and say, we cannot validate this claim. It is not actionable on our part. We are releasing it as a deterrent. And go back just a little bit.
I don't.
Let's listen to how he says.
Are they releasing it as a deterrent?
Well, that's the last line he says. Go back just about 20 seconds before you ended there.
I remember a lot of things. So where is the declassified information other than you coming out here and saying?
Matt, I'm sorry you don't like the format, but we have
declassified. It's not the format, it's the content.
I'm sorry you don't like the content. I'm sorry you are doubting the information that is in the possession of the U.S. government.
No,
what I'm telling you is that this is information that's available to us. We are making it available to you in order for a couple reasons. One is to attempt to deter the Russians from going ahead with this activity. Two, in the event we're not able to do that, in the event the Russians do go ahead with this, to make it clear as day, to lay bare the fact that this has always been an attempt on the part of the Russian Federation to fabricate a pretext.
Yeah, but you don't have any evidence to back it up other than what you're saying. It's like you're saying, We think we have information.
See, this is the thing where prices say, like, that's fine because it's deterrent. We are using this as a deterrent, period. And that is we hope that it deters them from creating this video. And in the event that it doesn't deter them from creating the video, we hope that it deters the world to see that video as a legitimate reason and pretext for an invasion. And I think that is a good reason to come out with this information. You just got to be honest about it. And instead of making it like you don't believe us that we have it, you just say, like, it doesn't matter if you believe us if we have it.
But then the fear is that this underpins a larger effort, probably by the United States government, to discredit anything that is coming out of, like, that is maybe anti-U.S., pro-Russian information. Then you can say,
but that video has nothing to do with the U.S.
I understand, but in terms of, like, this proxy battle that is being waged, basically, or could potentially be waged in Ukraine.
I mean, if it was something to the effect of NATO has encroached upon Russian territory, and here is a NATO, NATO military equipment in Russian territory or in Ukraine, for that matter, that has been firing at Russia, then I would be more skeptical of something like that because it would give the NATO or the U.S. some type of cover story, we're getting into multidimensional chess here, but to simply say, to come out with a story that says, like, if there is evidence of, Russian separatists fighting and Ukrainians killing Russian-speaking people in Ukraine, be very, very skeptical of it. And I, to me, the release of that information, the release of that specific information, if it has any impact, it diminishes the chances of people of a war, of an invasion, or of killing.
I hope that that's the case. If that's the case, then that is the overall goal.
The theory would be like it's like the USSR saying, "Hey, take a close look at anything coming out of the Gulf of Tonkin in the next few weeks," right? And I think that's good, but I also think like
there's a better way to do it without having to be like, "How can you not trust the U.S. government?"
It's gotta be with
seriously.
Partners. Sources and methods, like, give us some of that, because they're not really releasing information. They're hinting at the information that they can't release.
And if you are, then just come clean about that. Say, look, we can't substantiate this. We're not going to substantiate
it.
We suspect it. We're putting a marker down.
Rather than saying we have stuff that our spies got.
You're absolutely right to want more evidence. Can't provide it at this time.
Right.
And it still has the efficacy of everything we want it to do, and that's why we're releasing it. Because there's no secret here. I mean, there's no, like, secret game that's going on here. It is, they're basically saying, we saw what we think was that guy putting a couple of aces in his pocket. And so if he shows up and puts four aces down, that's very, very suspicious.
Right. Well, I mean, the point is just that I think that their posture of, like, the transparency that you're asking of them is incompatible with the way that they operate. And so they treat, even if we're taking the deterrent at face value and their intentions are good here in terms of, like, a broken clock being right twice a day or whatever. I mean, that then the issue is that their response is the same when they are parroting propaganda
that's what I'm saying.
And disinformation.
I think what they're doing is actually a positive. And I think that the way that they're doing it is undercutting both what they're doing and just sort of a little bit of gas.
And given the United States is like a history and it being in its lies that I don't know if it's even possible for them to do what you're saying.
Well, I mean,
don't even know if it's compatible.
You just come out and just say, like, it's not an actionable claim. It's not even one that we can are willing to prove. Acknowledge that. And so if people want to disregard it, they can. It's out in the public now. And that's all. And its efficacy is not undermined. by us putting that out. I mean, look, if every conflict from
if
now
those are
until,
their intentions, Sam, though, right? I mean, if those are their intentions.
But yes. But I think that if you're going to try and start a war because of a claim that somebody's making a fake video, you're on shaky ground.
But that's just one piece. There are, that no one's making the claim that that would happen. That's one part.
Yeah, I guess. It just seems like a not terribly nefarious thing to do unless it's used as a pretext for war. And so, I mean, in my estimation, if every government could come out and make that claim at any given point and it stops invasions and wars, and even if they're making it up, I'd be down with that. If that was the way that we could stop all wars, I would be totally down with it. And you know, I don't know why Russia feels like it would need a pretext necessarily. I mean, to whom they're trying to, you know, maybe that is an internal domestic political issue and a way to, you know, to drum up domestic support for an invasion like that, which I imagine it is. Then, you know, to undercut domestic support for a war, I think that's good. I think Russia should do the same thing, but I don't think it's necessary. I don't think there's any appetite in this country at all.
No.
To get into this conflict. It's really just sort of a high stakes negotiation that hopefully does not spin out of control.
It's just like,
I mean, this is what happens when you have an intelligence community that's blown its credibility for the entire time that I've been alive.
Absolutely. And I think you got to sort of, if you're the U.S. government and State Department, then you got to acknowledge that. If you want to effectively deploy this as a deterrent, and even acknowledging like we cannot show you proof.
Yeah, but that would require.
And skepticism is okay. You do that, and then you still, you know, that's the way you get the story out there, because you want that story out there, because you want to undercut and block the ability of something like that to be used as a predicate to a war.
That would require like a parallel universe in which the United States did not operate in the way that it has over the past 100 years.
I just feel like that wouldn't have been hard to figure out. A decent spokesperson, I feel like, could have
done. Well, he sucks.
Dank Uger. Wow, awesome lineup of guests today. Still, I can't help but notice you're still blackballing AOC and Beyonce and LeBron James and Tom Brady and the Pope from appearing on your show. Also, David Cross was the most underrated show of last year, Station 11. Check it out. Oh, yeah, we already talked about that. Legend ended. Nina, so happy to see Nina. Sam, thank you. Would love to see you both talk to Nina about things you may not agree with her on. Her perspective is always unique and brings to empathy and understands the pain of Trump voters, which you or Emma are incapable of. That's true. But I don't have to run for election in Ohio. She does.
Yeah.
Wrong intro. Ask David Cross about his billionaire phone call video. Oh, shoot. Phil McCracken, new nickname for Joe Rogan, Bropa. Don't know what that means. Ray, wrong intro. Confounded. Sam, did you get to read the New York's magazine investigation of millions of dollars of funds misused and redirected by a BLM founder? I had donated multiple times and it pains and hurts to know that we can't trust enough. Mm-hmm. Sickening. I did not see that.
I'm sorry.
Sam's forgotten mustache. What up, MR homies? My school had to call an emergency half day today because so many staff are out sick. Remember to wash your hands off and stay safe and healthy. Difficult. Nicole from Buffalo. Ned Price had another rough one. Mike Lee, yes, we just did that. Fierce Deity. AOC. The whole point of Tip O'Neill and Reagan being friends was that Tip O'Neill thought Reagan's ideology was bunk and it worked against while he was doing politics. Joe Biden doesn't understand that to go for the at the end of the day we're friends angle, he has to go hard against Mitch McConnell's ideology when it comes to politics, indeed. And you also don't go out there and say it unless you think it's going to hurt people. That's why, like, you know, Biden saying, like, I love Mitch McConnell should be a way of putting more pressure on Mitch McConnell.
Yeah. But you can't do that at the National Prayer Breakfast.
Ugh. I went there.
They're all
when I worked in
together.
Congress, I went there, and I can't remember who spoke, but I think it was, like, Bob Dole. It was creepy.
Yeah, I mean that.
Oh wait, no, it wasn't the National
Jonathan Larson of TUIT has been covering the National family. Prayer Desk Breakfast every year. He's done some work on it, and you guys should check that out.
I don't think it was that, actually. I think it was actually like a farm thing. It was like a National 4-H Club, but it still seemed pretty prayery to me. Okay, 10 more. Randy, for the left, as a Marxist, Leninist, anti-imperialist, American patriot, I feel the live show in Brooklyn should headline AOC. All right. Chad, the squad, runs Sam's Twitter account. This is a violation of ethics and debation. I know who very vigorous master debater who is outraged. All right. Salty line cook. Sam and crew wanted to know if any of you read about yesterday's recall vote of the Shasta County, California sheriff. No. Culmination in a two-year-long effort by local militia members and Trump types involved in the State of Jefferson movement. Things like this are happening all over California, the Pacific Northwest. It's disheartening to see separatists gaining real traction in our own backyards. Hope everyone has a great weekend. Joy Bevan. Hi, Sam. Checking in for Minnesota. The fun news is I finally became a member this week. Oh, well, thank you.
Charge.
Bad news is Minneapolis police murdered another black man this week. Yep, we covered that. Anyway, love the show and especially our Midwestern hero, Matt. Protect him at all costs. As a latecomer to the show, what does Left is Best come from? Take care, gang.
So there was a guy early in the Trump administration, I think, so there was some vandalism at a school park.
In Connecticut.
And it had a whole bunch of things on. I can't remember what the other things were, but one of them was Left is Best.
They put graffiti on to do the vandalism.
and as if it was like Antifa doing that, and it turned out to be like a sort of a false flag of a Trumper trying to make the left look bad.
And so
we embraced it as if Bernie Sanders was telling people to go out and spread.
Don't forget,
spread the message. Come on,
left is best. Everybody knows that.
Get your coupons for paint.
Antifa going around. Left is best. It just
break something next time though.
Couldn't come up with anything better. Hey, but you want also something that will reach everybody. You don't want it to be too complicated. Socialist Bear, can Ben speak about Amir Locke police shooting in Minneapolis? He did. That's not fraud. David Cross is amazing as Gil in Station 11 on HBO Max. In my opinion, one of the best shows of last year's show. Dark show makes you feel good about being alive and human. Check it out. Yes, I really enjoyed that. KC Answer. Love the show. David Cross is so funny. Is that John Benjamin guy coming back? F that guy. Judy Ruliani, Mr. Show, you have Ronnie Dobbs on the show. You know what we also have? I don't know if you guys have ever noticed this. On the door, see a couple of those magnets?
Mm-hmm.
The original Mr. Show convention. That was the logo there. Yep. Amy drew.
There's so much like bizarre memorabilia in this office.
Yes, it really is a lot of strange stuff. J-Man Raps. Hey, guys, happy Friday. My Raps are on a roll looking for another win tonight against Trey in the Hawks. How are those Knicks doing, Emma? Anyway, just a reminder, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger are corrupt authoritarians, not heroes of democracy. Indeed. Aster Winvitha. Can we please address the elephant in the room? Peter Ducey is a Tim Heidecker character. All right, three more. Slavoj. Sam, I heard the live show is going to be a display of pure ideology. Jesus Christ, that sounds good. Can my noise band Pure Ideology open for Grimes? Also, you should look into getting C.K. Lewis, the comedian.
I think it's the other way around.
Avelin Gogoris. I Googled my nearest COVID test and ended up with an enema and no kidney. All right.
Okay.
Prairie Fire Kowalski, howdy MR crew, no nose from me today. And the final I am of the day.
God, we'll save this for Monday, but Jimmy Dore did a segment on Sacha Baron Cohen's CIA connections, maybe. Anyway, keep going. Final I am, sorry.
Oh my God. I gotta wait and see what the Home Office says I gotta say about that before we... We may have to cut Sacha Baron Cohen loose.
We might have to.
Yep.
The comedian who came in from the cold. The clown who came in from the cold.
Maybe it's not a...
He's been a,
it's not
he's
a
been
coincidence
compromised.
That his wife, her first acting job in the U.S.
Whoop.
Came from me.
Mm-hmm.
So...
That's how you establish sources.
All right. Matthew from Indianapolis. Since Republicans have held Southern women, et cetera, since Reagan, could it be that they realized women could identify with strong Democratic or progressive women? So attacking them in this way functions to insulate them from losing their female base. So over-sexualizing them while painting them as stupid creates an extra layer of female competition, dynamic, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's maybe some of it, but really what it is like their base is white men. And so if the idea of showing uppity, young women of color in particular is, and being bashed is, I think, for whatever reason, very titillating for, older white men.
Mm.
So
whatever reason,
there you go, Matt, Bradley, Emma, great job this week. See you on Monday. To get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. See the truth in a light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.